The roll call, please.
Mr. Marley?
Here.
Mr. Brady? Mr. Bartlett? Mr. Stanley?
Here.
Mr. Fondren?
Here.
Mr. Leeds?
Here.
Hey, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anyone here to address the committee? Adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, and or reject November 16th, 2022 L&R committee minutes. Do I have a motion?
I make that motion to approve.
Second?
I'll second.
Motion and second. Any discussion? Any corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. All right, let's dive into the meat of it. Review, discussion, and possible action on board statutes for possible future legislation, possible future rules package, and substantive policy statements. Mr. Winter, where would you like to start?
Well, we can...
In this 102-page document.
I know. But I have now the Word document up, and I think the first thing that comes up...
that we haven't already discussed or...
Is this the definition of dwelling. We kind of hit on it at the last meeting, and for this meeting I had grabbed some definitions from other Arizona titles and statutes and rules that had to do with dwelling or residential dwelling or dwelling unit. And it was just for the board, for the committee, to kind of see what other language is out there. This, what you're seeing on the screen right now, is kind of where board staff is kind of liking the language that's highlighted.
And we should say, after, I don't even know how long, we, I mean, we hashed over these definitions for a ridiculously long period of time. And this is the one that we felt like was a good, for what... the purpose of what it was. And just so you know, our thoughts behind it while you're considering it, and we, of course, welcome your input and helpful knowledge here, but the reason we left or other substantial structure, so we didn't come up with that. This was taken off of other, Frankenstein out some of the other definitions. But because of the issue with... guest homes, casitas, that kind of thing, we wanted to leave it broad enough that if something came up, that it could go to the board and be considered as an other substantial structure if somebody felt strongly enough that it was.
I would say, because some of the issues that we run into is just what the four units or less that's currently defined. Right now, we do have individuals, home inspections done, like a condominium, a unit, an apartment complex, a high-rise, what have you, and we're not counting them as for parallel inspections. We look at Google, we see on the map, we see 5 AC units on top of that building, it looks like it's a 5-unit, so it doesn't count for a home inspection. And from what we're gathering from the home inspectors is that a home inspection should just be of a unit. It shouldn't... The structure itself, the whole building, shouldn't stop them from being able to do a home inspection on a single unit within that structure. And how it's worded now, it is preventative. If it has more than 4 units in that structure, then you can't do a home inspection.
So if you had a multi-story condo...
For the record, Mr. Stanley just left, so I think we may have lost the quorum.
Oh, no!
Maybe he's trying to dial back in.
Okay, hold your thoughts. Oh, there he is.
It's back on. And Mr. Bartlett has just joined the meeting as well.
Oh, excellent. Thank you.
We were
expecting
him too, so.
Okay, excellent. Okay, we have anywhere.
These two seats here, that one over there.
All right, I'll just sit here.
It's my third meeting this morning.
Yeah, right. Oh, thank goodness. Just lost form for half a second, and now we're in business.
So, I guess the put up line, do we want home inspections to be very narrow, specifically like a single family home kind of thing, or do we need it expanded so it includes basically any dwelling unit within any kind of structure, high-rise, condominium, mobile homes, manufactured homes, casitas, things of that nature? How broad or how narrow does it
have to be?
We need to expand it.
Okay, and I don't disagree, but I want to make sure that however we approach this, we're looking at, let's say it's a 10-story, 20-story condo high-rise, and your home inspector's doing the home inspection, and it's more just in terms of the awareness of the limitations of the scope of that inspection that are communicated to the seller and buyer, because... let's say there's a problem with the central plant and the cooling system. Takes a dump, you know, 2 months after they occupy, and they come after the home inspector because, well, you should have told us that there was a problem with the cooling system. No, the cooling system he evaluated, the fan coil in that unit, everything looks good, everything he or she is evaluating is a part of that. Let the record show Mr. Leroy Brady joined the meeting.
Everyone's looking for free pizza today.
So I just want to make sure that that's communicated clearly. I am all in favor of expanding the scope. It's just we need to make sure that there's buyer beware that if there's a problem in the overall infrastructure of the condo building, that we don't have a problem. We don't create a problem
Peter,
for our home.
Thank you. I think that's pretty well covered in the... scope of the inspection that says that we operate systems based upon homeowner availability, homeowner normal homeowner controls. Okay, the homeowner's not going to go anywhere near a chiller or a boiler system, you know, and neither will the home inspector.
Sure.
So, he's also going to end up deferring much of the structure, especially if he's up on the third floor or 15th floor. All right.
Well.
But the industry right now, I mean, what we're building are townhouses and condos.
Yeah.
I mean, they're popping up everywhere.
It's a huge market.
And they need inspections. And what that inspection is generally limited to will be the immediate systems that the homeowner is responsible for.
And I think a lot of that is going to be covered in the purchase agreement.
Oh, sure.
You're buying a condo. I always liken it to you're buying to the inside of your backside of the paint.
Right.
So, like, if there's a failure in the curtain wall system on this high-rise condo, that's a part of the shell building, and that's somebody else's headache.
Right.
But I just...
And most of the home inspectors are actually walking away from association-maintained items anyway. And the structure, the landscaping, the site drainage, things like that on a condo or a townhome would be association maintained. And even the roofing, you know. So they end up, something like that ends up generally an interior inspection plus systems.
Yeah. Okay. Then I'm very comfortable.
And I don't think we need to note that. I think it's well handled in the rest of the provisions for home inspections.
I think your standards are basically just allow, if they can't do it, that they would have to indicate that on their reports.
Sure.
That's right.
Maybe they would probably do a clarifying statement, did not evaluate condition of central plant.
That's right.
And just so you know, too, AC Ashe completely agreed in their revision to the four units or less should come out.
Yeah.
And so in their revised standards of practice.
The other question I have is the word substantial. Is that defined somewhere?
Right. Or Scott might chime in on that. Any thoughts?
Substantial to me means legally a lot to a lot of people, a lot of different things to a lot of people.
But is it broad enough that if there's something that comes up that there's a question on, it could come to the board, it would go to the board for their final determination, but is it broad enough that it that it, you know, because we've got, we felt like it was important to name mobile home, manufactured home, because we've had home inspectors mm-hmm. that said, oh, mobile home doesn't count. That doesn't count. It's not a home inspection. I don't know where that comes from, because if you go down the checklist of what an inspection is, it absolutely would fit.
It's always counted.
That, right. So why anybody would say that, I don't know, but, you know, I've heard that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing you're missing up there is what, maybe containers.
Well, that could be a substantial structure.
But I would think, I mean, to me, shipping containers more about
building material,
how it's constructed versus, so to me, it's a home, it could be a condominium, it could be a townhome. So I think it already, I'm almost wondering if we just get rid of other substantial structures. We pretty much cover the gamut, but I don't. Mm-hmm. I understand wanting the flexibility.
What about things such as, you can say, including but not limited to a house, apartment?
Are we keeping 10?
No. That was the original that we came up with at the last meeting to kind of start the discussion.
But we felt...
Well, that would be nice to have in there if you wanted to change substantial to dwelling structure. Or other dwelling structure, and dwelling means a place intended to human habitation.
So we were looking at, instead of just dwelling as the definition, saying residential dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
And if I may, some of the things. So like residential dwelling, dwelling unit, residential dwelling unit, dwelling. I mean, there's lots of kind of options. It doesn't necessarily have to be dwelling.
But we, again, kind of we're leaning towards, for purposes of this definition, residential dwelling, because this definition that we're looking at is put in there really as for the home inspectors, because if you look at the other, like the architects and things, the definition that's detached single family residence, or that was
exemption.
Put in for that
versus
residential dwelling is more to address the issues that we have with the home inspections.
Sure.
So,
yeah, on number 17, I would keep the word residential.
Yeah, I wanted residential dwelling also.
I agree.
Like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much blue.
And Scott, if I know you can't give advisory opinions uh-huh. on what should or shouldn't be, but if there's a legal implication to a word choice that we're using that we're missing, I hope you would share that with us.
Well. The problem is there are going to be legal implications to every possible word you could choose because you're drafting statutes. The important structural thing is going to be to make sure that you're using the same terminology across multiple statutes or reports, and also to keep in mind that if you have to interpret it right now, that means that a committee or the board will have to interpret it at a later date. And if you think that, well, it's just understood that this is how things are handled, it may not be clear to a latter committee or board that that's how it's handled. And if a statute specifically states something, they may well receive legal advice to simply follow the statute as drafted. So, if you're including or excluding certain buildings, I would be, legally speaking, it's generally safest to be as clear as possible regarding exactly what it is that's being regulated. That's probably about as far as I can really go in terms of statutory construction.
So that makes sense. I mean, because when we were debating this, again, for, like, longer than I want to admit yesterday, I did wonder if it should have one more little piece after or other substantial structure, but then I got lost in the weeds on saying, because, Kurt, where's that other definition that talks about, you know, the things that home inspectors had brought up before in the HRSC committee, which was that with immediate street access, with its own component, let's see, whatever, what does it say?
Yeah, you its own service, its
yeah,
own...
Yeah, 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 all of those
utility.
Things.
This one here under
and then I'm like,
property.
Yeah, that's, so that's...
That's way too restrictive.
Title 33, right, and that's why, I mean, I say, I thought maybe it needs one more little piece, but then literally got lost in the weeds, and we'd already hashed it over for so long that I'm like,
Well, this would actually preclude condos and townhouses. You couldn't do a home inspection on a condo or a townhouse
right.
under that definition because they are definitely going to share heating and cooling systems. And they're not going to have necessarily have direct street access.
Okay, so that's a bad...
That one, throw that
thing.
One out.
Okay.
That's an easy one to get rid of.
If you go back to 10, what if we were to take... the word substantial out and just put habitation structure or other habitation structure. Would
habitable,
that work?
Habitable structure
or other habitation substantial structure meant for human habitation? Intended for human habitation?
Who was it that said we do it including but not limited to house, apartment, blah, 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 townhome, period, and just get rid of all that?
I've never seen a definition that says, I don't know, including but not limited to. That doesn't sound like a definition.
I think my contract says that about 8 times.
Well, it sounds like something in a contract to me, but not, not necessarily a definition.
It doesn't sound like regulatory language.
What if you... Would that work if after structure you said intend, you took that top little bit and just added intended for human habitation? Does that?
I think you might even be able to get rid of the word substantial there. Right?
Yeah, what does that add to it?
I think
that's substantial.
I'm just gonna go way out there and go.
That's
about,
where you
so
have to go.
Somebody pitches a tent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's a structure intended for human habitation.
And I'll inspect it.
There's
some close by, too.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that's okay. I'm just saying, but that's...
I know, and that's the way, unfortunately, that you do have to think. It is like that, because, somebody will do it.
If someone will pay for it, and you inspect it, and it doesn't have all the systems that, you know, a tent can't possibly have, why not call it an home inspection?
Yeah.
I don't know. You ever gone glamping? Those are really nice tents.
That's true.
So, substantial, by definition, is of considerable importance, size, or worth. You know.
It must be another definition, right?
So, you're not going to talk about a tent if it's a substantial structure. Considerable amount, size, quantity, material, tangible, real.
What about the permanency of it? How a tent doesn't
or rather permanent
stay very long.
Well, that's why we took out that original definition that had. Recreational vehicles, houseboats.
It had houseboats and vehicles.
Yeah, they were like,
You see, I would inspect those too.
but for purposes of...
tangible properties, that could be great.
What a report that would be. How about permanent instead of substantial?
Permanent structure?
I think we might end up with a conflict because it's a mobile home... Permanent. It depends on how. Now it depends on how you define permanent.
Right, but a mobile home
because
has
a mobile home, you could
take
it up to the back of a truck and move it. To me, permanent implies a foundation system.
Scott, if we said or other permanent structure, or because it's an or not an and, would that leave mobile homes okay in the definition? Right.
Well, I mean, structurally, there are a number of different ways to do it. You could also list out that a home, by definition, includes mobile homes, other, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So you can also specifically include in a statute reference to things that you would like to have included under the definition.
So we could have residential dwelling means a self-contained unit of accommodation used by one or more households as a home, period, and then have a separate definition for home?
Well, you could say a dwelling is a, and again, I can't give you specific language, but you know, something along the lines of a dwelling is a building intended for human habitation containing the following characteristics. Additionally, a dwelling specifically includes mobile homes and other vehicles designed for human habitation, whether at a specific location or, you know, with hookups to provide for, et cetera, et cetera. So you could include it in the definition of a dwelling that way.
Oh my
gosh. It doesn't just have to be one sentence that encapsulates everything that possibly could be a human habitation across the whole of America. It could be a couple of sentences that include, you know, just be aware that the more specific you get, you do run the risk then if there's something that doesn't fall into that definition, you know, if you get too specific, you could rule out some things that might otherwise fall under it.
Right. That's exactly why I wanted that last little bit on the or, after the or. What, Kurt, why do we have over an extended period of time? Where'd that come from?
I just added it some time ago, but we didn't get to it.
Oh. I don't think that matters, right? Because how long anybody's in a residential dwelling.
Nope.
Yeah.
Just like hotels,
vacation
rental, residential, right?
Community. That coming after.
Let's not bring that into the
well, I'm just making sure, you know, hotel room wouldn't count as
a
residential something, right?
Mm. Now you can see why we spent like an hour on this.
What if you did something such as, or other structure intended for prolonged human habitation?
I just don't know if we care if it's prolonged or short-term or whatever. Yeah. That it's human habitation, not, you know, a bird sanctuary or something. But I don't know that we need prolonged or any time frame.
How many other structures are there?
So should we just take out
substantial?
That's what
I was trying to figure out.
I was trying to think. The only thing I can think of we missed was a shipping container. So.
Yeah, but my partner lives in a shipping container house.
Oh, no, they're, yeah, they build them out, build houses out of them.
Yeah, it's,
sure.
They are.
I've lived in them. In forward operation bases and things like that, they're pretty nice.
There's one
that's
really
my partner's.
Cool. The green one. That's all with the angle. That's awesome. Yeah. My wife got a tour of that.
So if all we can come up with is shipping container, why don't we just add that in there too?
Because I would argue that a shipping container is just a house.
It's a way of building a house.
It falls within one of them. Manufactured home. I mean,
mobile.
Well, and most of those are reviewed by traditional code review agencies.
Oh yeah.
If you weld them together,
city
and
of
make
Phoenix,
a house out of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you make a house out of it. The city of Phoenix,
insulated.
Or the city of Flagstaff, or the city of Tucson.
I want to see
the footings. And give it a permit. It's going to have footings.
My partner's is decidedly not mobile.
It is not
going anywhere.
Actually, I know the one he's talking about. It's on drill piers.
He's got piers and everything.
Mm-hmm. And it's cool. It sits up off the ground.
Yep. Well, if containers actually fall in mobile or even
manufactured,
why don't we put a period after townhome and be done with it?
Because then you leave no, then you just listed out everything with no catch-all that could go before the board should something else with a different name somehow
such as,
come up.
These are just examples.
Mm. such as does make it examples.
Yeah.
Such as.
Well, then you could say or similar or something like that.
Or what? Okay, or similar structure instead of substantial structure, or similar structure intended for human habitation.
For habitation. I'm okay with that.
Doug.
All right,
Doug. Winner.
You earned your pizza.
Good, because I'm hungry.
We'll take the check off for
I
being
like
late.
It.
Right? Yeah, that's true.
I like it.
Thank you.
Anyone
see,
on the phone
you just need a room full
comments?
Of great minds.
Right.
Does structural engineer have any comments?
Mr. Stanley, any comments?
Mr. Stanley's probably wondering why we're still debating.
He's on mute. Right.
I think we're good. Let's move on.
I'm for that.
Get rid of all the other ones.
I'm just glad you got rid of the term hookups.
Yeah, that just seems wrong on multiple levels. Yeah.
And we're keeping it residential dwelling and not dwelling, correct?
Correct. Well, residential dwelling, yes.
Up and down.
Okay.
I'll figure out this number. Okay. I think that was mainly it in our definitions. I don't know if anything else. I'm going to change these up. So you can ignore how that is right now. I was trying to have it similar to other statutory changes where the program was approved or acceptable to the board and not approved by the board.
I like
I just need to change the wording just a little bit more so it's more readable. Because right now we have, like, as an engineer graduate, which would be a graduate in a school accepted in our program acceptable to the board in engineering.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. We can fix that.
Something like that.
Just highlight it. We can read it again later.
And land surveyors and geologists would have similar language when they're in training.
I might suggest that we change that to graduate of an engineering school and program acceptable to the board.
Well, it might not be an engineering school, but have
I don't know, it just
a
reads
program.
Strange to me having board in engineering.
Maybe you need to say engineering program acceptable. What do you think? School and engineering programs. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That'll work.
Okay. You said this is similar for other definitions?
Yeah.
Just the one that have the EIT.
Geologist and land surveyor would have similar language that would read like this. So I would add geologist program or geology program and land surveyor program.
Right.
Yeah, that looks.
Yeah. And I can do that at a later time to press on.
Okay.
So we're going to stick with the residential dwelling.
Yeah.
We can come back to firms at a later time. Get to the other stuff.
So, yeah, that's where we left it last time.
This one, I know last time you had asked why do we have registered in there, and I had said it would clarify that they have to be registered with the board and not just an architect that's anywhere. Fine. Is that, you guys agree with that?
I'm fine with that, yeah.
Okay. Should it specify Arizona? Registered?
Mm-hmm.
I think under qualifications.
Correct.
Because yeah.
It talks about the
under
being
this
registered
chapter.
In the state of Arizona for a minimum of 5 years and things like that. So I think that's how it is.
Yeah.
And we left control of the alarm patrol agent in there? Is that what's still on there?
I didn't see him.
Number 7, one certified controlling person.
Had it still on there.
Yeah.
That's highlighted. I also have it just highlighted on the 6. I think we just need, I don't know if we know exactly where we want those numbers to be and stuff, but I think there's differing opinions on number 8, so we just kind of left it there highlighted.
That just reads my certified controlling. Is that what they actually call them?
Yeah.
It just sounds like you're bringing somebody in who's going to control everything.
I know.
That's what
I
mean.
That's my
job.
Yeah, exactly.
One certified controlling person is enough if you're talking about alarms?
One home inspector is enough, and one land surveyor is enough, and one geologist is enough.
Really?
And I thought the comments that were made at the last LNR meeting about being a controlling person versus an alarm agent, which the alarm agents can be much more transient, that was a great idea.
Yeah.
So then you're going to get somebody.
But I think we reduced public members to 3.
Right. I had it. 3, and then we changed to 4 and back to 3. So I'm just having it.
No, we changed it to 4 because we talked about actually dropping the alarm category altogether, but then we kept it. It took me a while to process. But if we keep controlling agent in, then it would be 3 public members. We take them out, but I would advocate for that another architect.
I don't disagree.
We didn't have controlling.
I don't either, but at least with the 2 engineers, we can really argue numbers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
But
no,
I
understand.
I would... I don't... The board is going to be so huge if that stays at 6.
Well, certainly.
Well, it can't.
I mean...
It comes unwieldy, yeah.
Well, don't you want to just put it at 3 now if you're going to leave those other ones in there?
If we're leaving controlling person in, then make it 3.
Okay.
Because then we keep the board size the same. We keep it at 11.
Which is already big.
Which is already 2 more than we had when I was on the board.
All right. Any other comments?
I mean, I think Criminal Justice Commission has like 15.
Right? Wow.
Yeah, that's a little crazy.
It'll be interesting to track how the participation is from the controlling person, because most of the controlling persons are with larger companies, and a
they
lot
won't
of times
show
are
up.
Out of state and
how,
they won't show up.
How
that's
many of them are
concern.
There? Controlling persons in the state. Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see the attendance record for who shows up and who has to show up at the meetings,
I can pull it up right now. So Julie's going to get those numbers for you.
Okay. That'd be helpful to me.
Yeah. I mean, if there's only a half a dozen of them in the whole state.
Well, and are they in the state?
Oh, no.
Because a lot of them are like
national.
But I think you have to be in the state to be a board member, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd have to reside in the state. So that narrows our pool. That I'm only bringing this up for discussion because I want to make sure that we have a pool of candidates.
481.
Okay.
Controlling people.
Controlling.
Wow.
Then we should have a good pool to draw from.
We've got 2,400 alarm agents.
Wow.
I mean, that dwarfs our number of home inspectors.
Much more.
Yeah.
4 times.
And
okay.
Actually,
3 times.
A lot of other professions. Hawaii numbers.
Yeah.
Twice.
Okay.
So
I say we go to 3 public members and we leave it as it shows, unless somebody has other ideas.
Well, they all get appointed by the board. I mean, by governor.
By the governor, yeah.
All right. So.
And
will he follow?
Curious to see what the
current
board thinks.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, that has to go there first.
Yeah.
So,
does the governor have to follow these rules?
No comments.
Okay.
When it's Never mind. Yeah. because in some other states, like I'm chasing Utah right now, and there say that the members of the board are selected from the professional associations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a lot of states are like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Canadian provinces.
Mm. I'll bet they get a lot of good work done that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the legislation that added them public to this required, I thought it was five.
It was six?
Six, yeah. And so is the legislature going to have a heartburn on that?
That depends too.
We don't know. But, you know, there's so many things I could say. I don't know. But this, I just struggle so much because I feel like this board is so unique. It's not just engineers and branches of engineering or something. It's these, I had a conversation yesterday with boards and commissions and I was pleading this point of seven very distinct professions that are very different. You know, how do you compare a geologist with a landscape architect? Whatever. I mean, they're very different professions. And so the whole point of, you know, avoiding protectionism and things like that, that's a struggle for me. Cause I don't know how that could be accomplished with this makeup even that we're proposing, you know?
Yeah.
So all you can do is try, and hopefully if you have the backing from the associations, national and state, and maybe hopefully a good lobbyist and the right sponsor, hope. Because the whole mission of the board, to fulfill its mission to protect the public, relies on a solid, participative, involved, board.
Yeah.
Board members who are committed and engaged and present and all of the above. So I feel like there's just a valid argument, but whether that means anything, from one small voice, no. It has to come from all the associations and everybody that wants that. So.
Right. 32106.02. So this is highlighted number one. And from discussions that I've had with staff is that this is kind of one of the things that got that dental board out in the Carolinas in trouble was the use of a cease and desist letter telling somebody, you have to stop what you're doing. And so we're very, I guess we feel kind of hesitant that giving the board this power could just get the board in trouble.
Well, who would send the letter if it weren't the board?
Executive director.
Oh, the executive director. Okay.
So,
that doesn't put you on the line for that? Like it wouldn't?
Well, of course it does.
How many of these have ever been sent out? I think we talked about this.
I mean,
we don't do it currently.
We don't have
it.
Don't do it currently.
We have that power.
So this is a new
adding that power to us.
I see. Okay.
Digging into my cobweb archives, and Leroy will remember these cases. We had a land surveyor at one point who had 11 open cases at the
same time. You're well aware that
we're still out there. And we always felt like if we had cease and desist authority, this would be the one case where we would really have liked to have used it. But it doesn't do it. It wouldn't have done any good anyway because this guy just keeps doing what he's doing. But I don't know. I haven't talked to any of your colleagues, Judith, about how, what they, I know other jurisdictions have cease and desist authority. I just don't know how often they've used it.
I mean, for all of the people that I talk to, not. They don't, if ever. And the thing is, it's, and I guess I'm referring to more of my counterparts in this state, in other boards, but nationally, I don't know how good of a comparison it would be to even ask my counterparts in other states, because I mean, it's very apparent to me as I go to these national conferences and things that things that are might be going on in one state, you know, another state, that their laws are a little bit different and the attitudes of the state are different. They say, oh, that would never happen in my state. You know, we would handle that, or we would do this or that. Things that we couldn't do, or, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just so, well, I don't know. Well,
to me, the dangerous ground we could be treading on is back to the more recent state Supreme Court case, which is part of the reason we're sitting here going through all of this. And my concern is, would it appear to be circumventing the normal, and I'm using all the wrong terms, but judicial adjudication process if something comes up in an investigation thing and you go, oh, we need to send a cease and desist. Well, suddenly that person has been denied the due process that we normally have in terms of how we resolve.
Well, if they ignore the cease and desist letter,
I'm just kind of,
then what?
Are we right back to where we started?
I don't think that there. Scott, can you help me with that? I mean, if a cease and desist was issued for some immediate public threat of egregious harm or something like that, that doesn't affect the due process of the investigation or the case, does it?
Well, first, I recommend against cease and desist in general, but if there's a cease and desist, an investigation could still carry on at the same time. A cease and desist isn't in itself a terminal act by the board. The board would send a cease and desist and continue an investigation, continue with whatever the process was.
Okay. I know currently there is a statute that allows us to do a suspension of a license under certain circumstances of a registrant, but of course that wouldn't help if it's a non-registrant.
How do you enforce a cease and desist?
Yeah, that was my question. Yeah.
The only way to enforce a cease and desist would be, it would be handled roughly the same as, well, I should back up, depending upon how the board goes about it. If the board has the statutory authority to issue a cease and desist, generally that statutory authority is designed to mimic an injunction that the board would obtain from the court. You'd send a cease and desist, and then you would proceed to court to enforce the cease and desist. But you do have to have the specific statutory authority to do it, and the problem is that authority does open up potential issues. Legally speaking, the collateral power would be the power to seek an injunction, which is different because a cease and desist is issued typically by a board, whereas an injunction, you proceed to the superior court to seek an injunction, and then the person has the opportunity to, everything is handled in a court, so you don't really have the opportunity to claim that the board is, there's a nefarious end to it in the way that can occur with a cease and desist.
Have you seen that language, Scott, in other boards that we could look at as an example?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Board of Accountancy has an injunction statute that is quite good.
Okay.
Let's see if I can find the specific reference to it.
You know what?
It is 32.750.
Okay.
Yep. 32.750.
Injunction against
unlawful action. You put ARS in your search. ARS.
Oh, it's ARS. I'm sorry. ARS 32.750. I apologize. Yeah.
There you go. Okay.
do have an injunction statute as well, which is 32.106.01, mm-hmm. petition for injunction.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
So that's for somebody, so 32.106.01A is for a non-registrant?
Well, they should all be for non-registrants. Typically, you would not be getting an injunction for a registrant.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and in the current language, too, it says issuance of an injunction shall not relieve the respondent from being subject to any proceedings pursuant to.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you can stop them from what they're doing, but still continue on with the investigatory process.
So it sounds like we'd be better to just leave what we have with the injunction.
I like that because it's a good tool. It's much it's more expedient than a summary suspension, which takes time because there's notice.
Well, again, a summary suspension can only be against somebody who is a licensee, injunction.
Correct. So that's
yeah.
So we still have that in our toolbox too. So I think maybe we can worry about this.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
You're welcome. Sure. Absolutely.
I'm gonna scratch it over here.
Delete it.
Yep. Okay. And I think that was the only thing that we had discussed that was still kind of contentious, I suppose, on that one.
I think so.
Again, with the in training, I had just changed the language here to be the program acceptable to as opposed to approved by. So,
okay.
Staff was emailing Mr. Marley about the architects that facility came down to this language. Staff just want to point out that it's the lowest of the big five in regards to amount of time. But I know you guys are saying that seat time, you're trying to get away from seat time.
Trying to get away from seat time. Now, I have a comment on this because I did talk with NCARB staff when I was back at the committee summit 2 weeks ago. Whatever that was, it's all a blur. and I think the one thing I'm concerned about with the language that I proposed here is it says, actively engage in education or experience or both in architecture for at least 5 years and then complete the applicable National Council Architectural Experience Program. I'm concerned that I don't want them to think that completing the AXP could be a part of that 5 years.
That's what I was wondering.
Which is how it could be. So
that's
I'm saying
exactly
we need to
yeah.
we need to rework the wording here to ensure the completion of the AXP is subsequent to the 5 year period.
Put an and in there.
Subsequent to completion?
I'm saying, yeah, I'm just wondering, can we do and complete and... Which is something that says subsequent to this five-year period. What the five-year period does is identifies the time frame at which then they can apply to start taking the ARE, which is really important. And then... And it doesn't preclude them from starting AXP at the beginning of this five-year journey and documenting. If they're an experience-only candidate, they could document 5 years plus 3,750 additional hours to complete the AXP as a part of their NCARB record. And it makes your guys' job really easy because all that employment's verified. You don't need any. They don't need to submit any forms.
Because Ed, you're saying the 5 years that should not include the time that it takes them to complete the AXP.
Correct.
Okay, so does it just need to say for at least 5 years in addition to completing the applicable National Council?
Or excluding.
Is there... can they earn experience prior to the AXP? Like, does the 5 years need to be education and experience? Or is it, what's kind of the...
Right now, the statutes have always been historically and or experience. So you can do 5 years of experience, 5 years of education, or any combination thereof. So if you go to Arizona State and you get a four-year Bachelor of Science in Architecture or Bachelor of Arts in Architecture, there's 48 of the 60 months. So then they work for another year. Now they're qualified to take the exam, and then that's when the AXP clock needs to start, the 3,750 hours in AXP. So I just want to make sure that they're not documenting, particularly for an experience-only candidate, that they're not thinking they can document that 3,750 hours as a part of that 5 years, because that...
Or what if they complete their 4 years, and then for that extra 12 months, they start their AXP?
Right.
So that's kind of overlapping.
That's where it's a potential overlap. And we need language that will avoid that.
Right.
And I don't have the magic words. I just created the problem.
In addition to.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
How come I can just beat you by this much every time?
We just think alike, Peter.
I know. It must be the position where you're
across the table.
Still not quite there.
Completing. Yeah.
Because if you've got the in addition to, then it's...
You have to put "in passing" if you're going to go with completing in order for the sentence to make sense, or you have to use semicolons. Well, Mr. Marley?
I'm pondering here.
What
we can do?
Yeah.
We can always, at some point when appropriate, we can always send this back to NCARB staff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Giving them a heads up that they'll be seeing something that whenever appropriate.
Is that language used in any other state for you guys?
No, I don't. We can check one of the other 17 jurisdictions that has this same approach. We can check Idaho. We can check California, New York.
I don't like the completing and passing. What if you were to put in words such as, in addition to the completion of the applicable National Council and the passing of the National, I guess we end up with the passing anyway.
Yeah.
So, how do you gain access to the AREs?
So right now you have two approaches. If you have a NAB accredited degree, you have set up your AXP file, your NCARB record, you've set it, if you've established an NCARB record and you have a NAB accredited degree, you direct apply it through NCARB.
Okay.
But the board is completely out of it. And I think they get notified. If you don't have a NAB accredited degree and you finish your 5 years, you apply through the board.
Okay.
For authorization to test.
I'm curious if you don't even need the first part of it, then it just say that you have to complete the applicable National Council Experience Program and pass the architectural professional examinations, because it's already kind of set up by NCARB how you get into the AREs. Is that first sentence?
I think because we are an education and or experience state, we need to keep that in statute. Because otherwise we don't really have any language elsewhere that talks about that first step. And a lot of jurisdictions just say, thou shalt have a NAB accredited degree.
Yeah.
And they're that explicit about it. They,
right.
You don't dance around the accredited degree program as approved by the board. They just say NAB accredited degree.
Yeah.
I think this is a good starting point, and then when we have NCARB review it, they can maybe help us wordsmith that a little bit if necessary.
That was
for engineers,
I think.
I don't want to just dump for everyone.
Okay. Staff can discuss it some more and get with maybe NCARB. I can always email you back with some changes that you're thinking of.
Okay.
Your input.
That'd be great.
Oh yeah, we value the input from the national associations. They've all been very kind to, you know, review and give input. And
I was curious what you guys thought, instead of having that is approved by the board when talking about the certificate of qualification or model law designation using in which the board holds membership, as it is in statute, this is as part of the powers and duties of the board is to have membership with national teams.
Yeah.
I think that kind of clarifies. I like that.
I did, too. When Kurt pointed that out, I said, oh, gosh, that makes a lot of sense, especially since it's in statute. To hold membership.
Okay.
And, well, number three,
5 years is highlighted, just because I don't know if that's a solid number, or I believe in the engineering section, it was changed to 10 years because we're trying to get rid of the exam waiver statute.
Okay. I think five for architects is good. I think that, I mean, there's no way to implement an exam waiver. We don't have an FE exam that we can waive, and we've got a block of six examinations.
But the professional, there's a professional exam waiver.
Correct.
I mean,
well,
and
that,
they,
yeah. Which, I mean, which we can keep if we want. It just means they'll never get, if we waive someone's architect registration exam requirement, they'd be licensed in Arizona, they could never get licensed anywhere else. Mm-hmm. But
like everybody else, they'd just be stuck here in the desire.
Yeah, which is, you know.
What are we talking about?
A lot of people, that's okay. You know. Quite honestly, when I went into this profession, I never dreamed that I would be licensed in 9 states and practicing all over. And it never crossed, you know, never crossed my radar.
Well, it's just because it matter what's practical. I got licensed in Nevada because I worked along the river.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, but I don't really care about going to work in Nevada anyway.
Yeah.
So
I think 5 years for architects is good.
Okay.
I think we had this discussion even at the national level where we talked about for education alternative programs that we've developed, I think we've got a 3-year requirement. And that was, to us, it was enough time for something. If there was going to be an enforcement issue come up, 3 to 5 years is kind of a window where it's probably going to come up.
Okay.
So I think I'm fine with it. With five.
Yeah. So we'll look at the others, too. I mean, I would assume maybe some consistency across the professions in that amount of time.
You have 5 for geology, I noticed.
So, again,
and if it needs to be 10 for engineering, that's fine too. If it's part of that,
I just I just know CLARB was pushing for 6, from 8 to 6.
For registration.
That's the initial
minimum monitoring experience.
I just wondered if they're coming from another
state. Oh, coming from another state.
This is a reciprocity, yeah. Comedy, whatever. Oh, I never.
Well,
number one,
sneaking the back door.
Initial. Number two, if you hold that certificate, but that kind of opens it up to people who might be outside the U.S. who hold a certificate.
Then that's okay.
Yeah.
We have lots of programs. We have lots of mutual recognition agreements in place that I'm actually very comfortable with that.
Very good.
We need to keep that as flexible as possible. So.
Yeah.
And number three is for that person who's registered but doesn't have. Certificate.
Doesn't have a certificate, yeah.
So I think it should keep the door open for all these different groups.
I think that's important.
And I think the only group that wouldn't have similar is the geologists, because you guys don't have the accrediting institutions and other things that kind of allow that. So that might be something to think about, but all the others.
Well, we have, AIPG has a certification. And, like, for instance, Alaska, that's all you need to get registered in Alaska.
Hmm.
Which, and it's only $75, which is why I'm registered in Alaska.
For life. For life.
For life.
Yeah. Mm. I can't turn that down.
We have to start pushing that around here. One fee for life.
There you go.
All right. I'm going to quick. Show you what Dr. Angel had shared for the engineer bit. He had some just trimming of language up here. I guess from his opinion, just strike all the designation and branch designation from the language.
I don't know.
We're definitely going back and forth and back and forth regarding if the branch designation part of it needs to be in statute. Mainly with that comment that I said there were 49 applications in 2022 where we did not know the applicant's exam, what they took. So NC's didn't have it, the state didn't have it, one of those kind of things.
49 applicants?
49.
Really?
Last year.
Wow.
So with that, you need some kind of mechanism to allow these individuals through. Currently, you can see that as maybe like the exam waiver. But the statute currently doesn't say branch designation, that's all a rule. They have to pass the exam with the branch designation, but they can get a waiver of that. So if we scratch the waiver statutes.
That makes me really uneasy. And the fact that I feel a little bit conflicted, because I know that I've had a lot of feedback that the engineers don't want to get rid of branch designation. I think NCWS would love us to get rid of branch designation. I'm against Switzerland for whatever needs to happen, but the homework project that is going to go into what it will entail to not have branch designation is huge. Because I know Hayden's already started some work on that. I mean, because there's no way we can just get rid of branch designation and not know the trickle down with all of the cities and municipalities and what their requirements, mandate on a seal. Like, I know Hayden's, I think you've already found out some do require like a civil or.
Yeah, it's like depends on the project. There was like some were civil, and in some they just specified like competency and whatever discipline it was, or field of,
and that was just like the tip of the iceberg, right? Because I mean, so we're a whole big state. We don't want anybody. We wouldn't want any surprises. You go to the legislature and say we'd like to homogenize this into just professional engineering, and have a whole bunch of backlash that you weren't anticipating or something on how the cities or towns or municipalities are being harmed by this, or even the whole of the engineering community that already have their registrations and are specific and have to get a new seal. And, there's just a lot that goes into that. So, I'm not saying I'm opposed to it one way or the other. I mean, I recognize we are really out of sync with most of the rest of the nation by being branch specific.
Mm-hmm. How many branches does Arizona recognize?
17.
17.
Yep. And gosh. NCWS has 24, I think. 23 or 24.
It's
a few more,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Because we have sanitary and geological engineering, which NC's does not have exams for.
Right, that's right.
And then they have maritime that we don't have.
But don't they also, they're branches of civil, they've got five specific...
That's that boat out.
House exams, but they're
still civil. Still civil.
So they probably have 24 exams.
By law.
But anywho, we're at a kind of like a, we don't know how to proceed with engineers. It's a bit more clear-cut with the others, but because of the branches of engineering, it's having a hard time kind of...
Right, and even when you talk about adding the comedy or reciprocity, you could do it with all the other professions except engineering as it stands because of that. Mm-hmm. Little hiccup, which isn't little, it's actually a really big hiccup.
Yeah. Maybe that's a hiccup for another year.
Judy, your recommendation is just to keep the branch designation terminology in there?
I feel like I have to think this through. I didn't feel good about it when we were, and I'm sorry Dr. Angel couldn't be with us today because that would have been a good discussion, but I feel like that one needs some more discussion because it is in rules, so I really hesitate to take that out of statute when it is in rule and so... drilled down in rule,
yeah.
You know?
I don't see any problem with leaving branch designation in there.
So
I frankly don't either. I'm concerned that we strip it out. That's a heavy lift.
Yes.
To clean all this up, to pull out at this point.
It is.
And we have to look at what is the ripple effect across the clientele that our registered serve. And municipalities.
Yeah. That's what really concerns me is all the rest. It's not just
when we put an expiration date on the seal, half the municipalities couldn't even figure that out. They thought my drawings expired. I mean, there was
just got a question.
And now you take off the their branch designation and. You know, my mechanical engineer stamping the mechanic, but they can't see that he's a mechanical engineer anymore. Some of these folks are going to struggle with that.
I wonder what Dr. Angel's reasoning was on that. He says
to me, if you're trying to protect the public, then these different branches of engineering in particular really matter, I think.
They do.
I think so.
Well, I think Dr. Angel has expressed that to me, too, that he prefers to have the branches in place. So, again, I was...
But his comments up here don't...
It would be good to.
So
we need him in this room.
Don't feel like conflicted. We might have to come back.
Does Mr. Stanley have an opinion?
I
can tell you that within the Department of Transportation, there are 700 some PE positions, and some of them are different branches. Mm-hmm. And
that's huge.
Yeah. And
I think you need
all
the
700 of them coming to the legislature.
Oh, no. Go ahead, Mr. Stanley.
I think you need them in there. I think it clarifies a lot of things. And if somebody from out of state doesn't have one, they should just show documentation, like what we do with somebody who's been working in the business for, 10 years or something like that, they can get a CO if they already have another CO or something. Isn't there a rule or a law to that effect?
It's 4 years of experience. If they're currently registered in one branch of engineering, if they can show 4 years of experience in another, they can apply that.
Yeah.
Well, they just have to show, but in order to do that, they have to show the expertise, and as long as he just shows that he's been doing these buildings for a while, we can say, okay, he's a mechanical engineer, or yeah, he's an electrical engineer, even though he doesn't have a designation from where he's coming from.
Let me go back to the other
okay.
For Mr.
So it becomes a judgment call.
Well, we just have to make sure the language kind of says that you can have a judgment call. I think how I have it written currently, it's a bit more, you have it or not. and that would require maybe that exemption to be re-looked at. So be actively engaged and experienced for both engineering specific to the branch designation, which registration is sought for at least 8 years, pass the national fundamental, and pass the national professional engineering examination in the branch designation. So I guess my reading, if it says in statute that you have to pass that in the designation and you can't provide us the proof of that, you would have to have some other mechanism. Oh, Scott, am I maybe just looking into it too deeply? Would that prevent something, or if they don't have it, would that just become an automatic denial? They can't provide that to you?
You know, could you read that back to me again one more time?
Are you on the phone or on the computer?
Yeah, I'm on both.
So it's, and pass the National Professional Engineering Examination in the branch designation in which registration is sought. And we might have those 49 individuals who can't give us that proof from just this year.
Right. And that, I'm sorry, Judy, I didn't mean to cut you off there. Yeah, I mean, the problem is you can, you know, if you require people pursuant to the statute to provide something that they can't provide, that's why you can get into trouble sometimes if you say, for example, they have to pass an electrical engineering program provided by one of the three Arizona State universities. Well, if they all stop offering that program, then you can't, by statute, you can't out licenses anymore in that area. So you can hamstring a little bit, like what you're talking about with the 49 applicants. It's typically good to give the board a degree of discretion when it comes to something like that, so that they can adjust requirements to meet the day-to-day realities of the changing landscape out there.
Kurt, I was going to say, for those 49 individuals who had their PE exam unknown, they could technically, it wouldn't be their initial licensure, so they wouldn't necessarily be applying through number one. They could use number three.
Because if it's initial, they're going to know what exam they took.
Right.
This is just somebody that took an exam in another state, and NCAAS lost the records, and they don't have proof of
And that state is not branch specific.
So they didn't care.
I was going to ask that, because, I mean, how can you not know what test that you took? I mean,
default
civil engineer. I mean,
some states, they just, because they're not branch specific, they didn't keep record of which exam was, or NCAAS lost some of that.
You just make them symbols.
Well, if they apply through number three, then they could demonstrate their experience in civil, regardless of which exam they took for many years.
So you're that. Oh, thank you. You say that you switched it.
So, okay.
Maybe you need to add another branch, general. General engineer.
Well, see, that goes to just PE.
Right.
Well, so I guess with that said, with these individuals who, you know, I got a project starting in 6 months, I want to get in here, but I've only been registered for 3 years in the other state. Like, they wouldn't meet number three if it says 5 years.
Right. You're going to have to produce something else, or
I mean, they could possibly hold the valid law designation.
Also has the exam in the branch.
Oh, you're right. It still has that exam information in there.
Well, should we? What would it do if we took out the exam? If we take out the branch designation, not the exam. Sorry, just the.
Issue is the exam issue.
That is the issue.
We don't know what that is.
But if they hold a model law designation in engineering, and then
their exam is unknown, then what do we do?
What's the only demonstrate what they can do, you know, active practice in the branch designation they're seeking. I guess the only difference then would from 2 to 3 would be that they have mala law.
And,
yeah.
And again, the mala law would allow the foreign applicants who have a doorway in.
So we go that way. I don't see how you can get rid of the exam.
How does NCWS handle foreign applicants? I mean, NCARB, we require that they take the ARE.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Unless there's an MRA involved, you know, if we have a mutual recognition agreement with a country, then we have a mechanism set in place to allow them to get an NCARB certificate. But if they don't, or if they aren't under an MRA, we require them to take the exam and complete AXP. I just wonder how NCWS handles something, a foreign app, you know, a foreign.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure about that.
Does Mr. Stanley know?
I know they can have their education evaluated.
Yeah, they can go
to meet the NCES standard. But.
And just, I'm wondering maybe number 2, instead of the examination, it could be like the active practice, just the show's experience in number 2 instead of the exam.
But I think the intention of number 2 is avoiding having to demonstrate. You apply with COEs, basically.
You apply with your NC's record, and you're supposed to, it's like an NCARB record.
There's also.
Well, again, if we're, you know, I'll just argue if the branch designation is important and it is so definitive and rule, then should we be that concerned about not having it? Are we, is the concern that we're blocking somebody? I think it can be just like it is written right here if the exam waiver still is in place, that the board has that ability. If they're a model law, if they have model law designation from NCWS, they took an exam. Even if everybody on the planet lost the records and we can't see which one it was, and that sounds so crazy, but.
So maybe you don't have this data, Julie, but. Of the 49 applications where the exam was unknown, how many of those were under an NC's cover?
Like model law?
Yeah.
That model. I don't know. But they were definitely registered somewhere else, mm-hmm. and at least like for 5 to 10 years in that other state. My concern with taking out the in the branch designation under number 2 would be, you have a model law, I took, you know, my civil exam, but I'm applying to be a structural here or a mechanical. So if you take out that branch designation part, then they could.
And that's kind of a big deal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it needs to stay.
It makes sense to me.
Makes sense to me to leave it in if you're going to keep.
Uh-huh. Why the highlighted or on number 1?
No, it's just pointing out this information.
Okay. You don't intend to take it out, then.
No.
All right.
I agree, though, that the backside of that would be municipalities and, you know, looking at whose seals are on what for approving things would be a nightmare to get through. They have a hard enough time now as it is to let alone change all that, and everybody's just an engineer. They wouldn't know what they were looking at. So.
That's right.
That would be a recipe for disaster.
And it sounds like we don't want to take it out, but we can definitely look at the exam waiver language, the possibility of keeping something there. Mm-hmm. So, move on if everybody's okay with that.
Sure.
With that knowledge.
And
we
take a break?
Yeah,
I was going
to say.
Pizza.
Can we recess?
Can we recess for 10 minutes?
10 minutes.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
And if you give me a couple minutes, I also have a salad in case you want to be healthy, which would be pizza.
For those on the phone, we're going to be taking a 10-minute break.
Thank you.
Okay.
We are recording.
All right, we will reconvene at 12:43. Next item.
I just noticed here in the geologist registration bit, there's some language that was cut out of the other ones that still remains here. Maybe just skip over geologist before or something. But we had taken out the highlighted text in the others. So it doesn't have to be substantially similar. You just have to demonstrate that you're or the other state active. So I would remove it and it would be the same as the other.
Well, that statement...
remove the shaded.
An admission yes. That there might be someone greater than us. There's no one greater than Arizona.
No.
And so, and again, it was already removed prior in the other four. I don't know why it wasn't removed here. I just want to verify that there was no reason that it was in this one, not the others.
Good? Yeah, that's fine.
Any input about 6 years? I mean, currently it is 8 years. We're good with 6 years?
Yeah, that's fine.
Let me unhighlight it so I don't have to bring it up. Currently 6 years for land surveyors, that kind of remains the same.
I don't have any problem with that.
Okay. So for both geologists and land surveyors, the 5 years holding registration elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
We did the 5 years there. Okay, I think 5 years seems to be the way we're going. Landscape architect, 6 years, dropped down from 8.
Speak up.
I guess, what are your thoughts on it being reduced from 8 years to 6 years of experience in education?
We did that, Libra, because Clarb was...
Yeah.
Pushing
no,
that. As their, you know, model law.
And now's the time to do it.
Yeah.
Good to go, we think, at 6?
Well, and there are a number of states that don't require 4 years of experience.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean... They require the degree plus 1 or 2 years of experience.
Doesn't sound like any.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay.
And engineers will
stay
at
8. Yes. Also, it doesn't take as long for landscape architects to learn things as engineers.
I don't think there's anything new below that. Staff is curious why there was exception for the architect applicant.
We're always exceptional. I don't know why.
I don't either. That always made me a little bit crazy. I'm like, what? Oh. This is the one where I felt like it should just be a majority vote, right? Not,
yes.
I don't know why. I don't know why it would be a 2/3. I mean,
yeah.
It should just be a majority vote.
Supervisor was the intern professional. How important is it that the immediate supervisor who's providing the certificate of experience isn't the profession? I don't know. Just reading H just makes it very important.
Yeah.
A high standard in which that isn't the case, and the board has 2/3 majority vote to overdo that.
So So that's saying 1 year can be obtained under the direction of a professional who is
without direct supervision of the registered professional.
If except for the permitted applicant was...
I think the reason architects were exempted is the whole AXP program has allowances for working for a contractor, working for an engineer, things like that, that we just kind of felt like it was potentially in conflict. Now, what I see is you pull that out, it allows a little more flexibility in that 5-year experience time frame. So I'm fine with it. Take the architect exception out and just let it go, apply to all disciplines.
Would you still think it needs to be 2/3 rather than just
the majority?
I don't know.
I'm not sure that.
I feel like
I'm trying to think that. I wonder if that's back to the old board structure. I
can't see why that needs to be 2/3.
See why it does.
When for the purposes of the board, when you say a 2/3 majority, that's a 2/3 majority of those present in voting or of the board. Period.
That's a very good point.
Another reason.
Well, I know, like in our association, we say those present in voting, and we say that because we don't always have that many people show up. But legally, I don't know how that. I mean, but we're not, you know,
Scott.
We're not held to that standard.
I think it would be, by who's present, but at a board meeting. Would you think that?
You have rules for a quorum, and that means the majority of the board is going to be there. So why wouldn't it be of the board?
Okay.
Who's present?
Mm-hmm.
Of those present. So.
But I would just say, let's just do a majority unless somebody has a really good argument.
I don't think there is a good argument.
Okay.
Yeah.
This
somebody
by Leroy.
Copied it from one of the referendums.
Well, if it was a geologist, for instance, I would certainly want to be there. I mean, I would want the geologist on the board to be there for that particular vote, right? I don't know. Whoever's in the profession of the person's applicant.
That'd be a little more tricky then.
No, I know.
Yeah,
but that's why if you said of the board instead of the voting members or whatever.
You never had a name.
All right. Not sure what convictions highlighted. I recall why that would be. So this additional language, all this extra blue. I believe we've talked about it in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. And I don't think I've changed anything, but for some reason, that might be just a leftover from last time. Is there any reason anybody has issues with the word conviction?
Why do we have conviction or summary conviction? Is that a distinction that has to be there?
Maybe a Scott question.
That's a Scott question.
Are they different, or can they just be conviction?
Did Scott fall off? Is he muted? Are they?
Yeah.
No.
Somebody was.
Are you there, Scott?
Yeah. Well, I was just about to ask Kurt, what page are you on the packet? Because I seem to be in a different spot than you are.
Yeah, it's 25 of 102, Scott.
Oh, 25. Okay.
Stop sharing.
Oh, that explains a lot then.
I'm sharing a Word document that I alter while they have
so
the immediate packets.
I'm tracking where we are so I can yell out page numbers if necessary, but 25 of 102.
Yep. Yeah. So your problem with the word conviction or summary conviction?
Just asking what the difference is.
Well, yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm not sure what a summary conviction would be unless you're talking about something that typically summary is something you're doing without a court proceeding. So unless you're talking about a summary suspension, which would be a regulatory action, but typically a conviction is a criminal proceeding. So a summary conviction, the only thing I can think of off the top of my head would be some kind of a court-martial proceeding, perhaps. But I'm not sure why that would be an issue.
So maybe we leave conviction, but strike some or summary conviction from the text. It sounds like.
Yeah, I'm not certain why a summary conviction wouldn't be caught up in conviction in general. So I'm not sure why there would need to be a summary conviction specification.
A possibility. You can be convicted of a misdemeanor as well as a felony, correct?
Or if we had to be specific about
either a felony or a misdemeanor would be a conviction.
Okay. I just wondered if we had to put misdemeanor or felony conviction versus like a traffic conviction, or,
So the definition, according to Google, is a summary offense or a petty offense in a violation in some common law jurisdictions that can be proceeded against without the right to a jury trial or indictment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I guess if somebody had a traffic conviction of some sort that would, I would imagine that would probably be encapsulated then under the difference of felony versus misdemeanor, where the drafting probably was encompassing conviction to be a felony and summary conviction to be a low-level misdemeanor that otherwise, I mean, it was a conviction. I'm not sure why they would remove it like that, but I don't think legally you need the distinction in there.
Yeah. Okay, and I removed it. So right now it just says if you had a conviction in the last 5 years, that the board won't look at it.
Yeah, Black's Law says minor misdemeanor. The main thing is that it was the sentence was imposed by a magistrate or a court, not a jury trial.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mr. Brady is leaving the meeting.
So this was the exemptions. Previously, we had scratched out just about everything except for the fundamentals language. In order to have the new comedy language, why have an exam waiver when you can just get your registration with the same standards that we had for the exam waiver in the past? But now, do we want to rethink some of this so that we can have those unknown exam holders be able to get that waived? That might be a thing where just maybe staff can create some language to present at the next one. I don't know if any of these currently work.
I think we need to rethink and present something to be considered.
I think now that we have understanding that we'll have to keep the branch designation in that language, then we can now proceed to try to get some kind of waiver away for these individuals without knowledge of the exam.
But that's only with reference to engineers.
Right? That is correct.
Yeah.
It could be made general, but it could work for anyone, or it could be very specific to engineers as well.
Where do you deal with waivers elsewhere? Do you or don't you?
Just the rules that correlate with statutes.
I think it's fine the way it is. I'm not sure I understand why it's not okay with the branches.
Well, we're going to keep the branches in the engineer language. Mm-hmm. And so with the statute saying specifically you need to provide us proof that you passed the engineering exam in the designated branch, And for those individuals, the 49 who could not do that, the statute is going to basically stop them from being able to come through that route, number one. They might still be able to go through two or three, but there still needs to be some kind of language that says that if you don't know your exam, that you can have it waived, if we can, you can show experience or something.
But this is just referring to the fundamentals exam, right?
Correct. What is left is just the fundamentals. So currently we don't have language to present regarding this. We wanted to talk about whether or not the branch designation was going to remain the registration language. Mm-hmm. But we, staff, can come back at a later time with language for exemptions of the professional exam for engineers specifically, or in more general, whatever. We can probably do both and present them both.
So with this language, or the one that was in there already, so you can get a waiver based on these requirements to not take the fundamentals, but you still have to take the principles and practices?
Well, are you saying that as they currently read
here,
right now? Right here, right now, all that red is not scratched out. That's how it is. You can have your professional waived by meeting one of these three.
The reason why I asked is I had an individual ask me who's got his LSIT but has not taken the principles and wanted to know if he could get a waiver, and I wasn't aware that can he?
If he qualifies under that
way it's currently written. Mm-hmm.
So you're taking away the waiver for the professional, but leaving
the fundamentals.
See, the fundamentals to me is not quite as anywhere near as important as the
The idea was to, by switching this out, we would just make it that there's more avenues to get registered. Mm-hmm. And they kind of are very similar language to what the current waiver is. Instead of your exam waiver, if you have a license somewhere else, we're actually just going to give you the registration if you show the experience in 1 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm. So you can apply to NCs and just take the principles? If you're waiving them, will they let you take the principles without taking the fundamentals?
If our board has waived it, we would go in and enter it as a waived exam, and then they could.
I know things have changed so much from 20 plus years ago, because you had to get approved then by the board to do anything. Now most boards just send you to NCs, and I had the same thing with Utah. I applied before I took my state exam, and they're like, "Why are you applying? Just go take the test." I'm like, "Well, I'd like to know if I'm able to take the test. If I pass it, are you going to give me a license?" And they looked at it, and they're like, "Yeah, fine." But they don't really say what that, how spell that out very well. But,
Your terminology on your last paragraph down there is the board shall waive. So you're making it mandatory.
It's currently mandatory.
Well. It is mandatory?
So it isn't statutory.
Okay.
I wish this had been in here in 1989. I wouldn't have had to take this done.
I don't recall the surveying fundamentals as much as I do the principles. I mean, it was only 6-hour tests. It was mostly definitions. But it's changed so much. I mean, drastically, since I took it in 98, 99, the NC's test is not even similar, but it seems. There's no way in hell I think I could probably pass it today.
Good thing they don't make us retake these exams once in a while.
There wouldn't be anywhere near as many professionals.
Just be careful if you ever go inactive and you're out for over 5 years, and we will make you do it again.
Yeah.
Gotta come back.
So is there a question on the 12, or did we address that? I just want you to take the yellow off if we've got it covered.
Oh, because that's just the current language. Is it 12 years?
12
is
fine.
12 is fine.
Okay.
It's been a long while.
Get rid of that so it doesn't come up again. This is a new one, the confidentiality law, because we just run into some interesting questions as of late. I think this would kind of solve some of those. The first one is scratching out that and having a more broad. Currently, whenever we get a public information request, requesting information of an application, it's a real pain of what can be given and what cannot be given based on the current reading. And so the proposed language, applications and all materials submitted or received as part of an application are confidential. It just, there's no gray area. It's just there. I'm going to say below, we have some exceptions. Currently, if you're an applicant, as soon as you turn in that application to us, that you're never getting any of that back. And if you put in a PIR saying, I want my application, all the things that are listed, you're not getting back. It's because we are the owners of this record. Even though it's your information, it's not your record, and therefore it's not privy to, you know, you can't give it out in this regard. This is what allow, except for the letters of inquiry and references, to be open to the applicant if requested. That's what would be the D. So, make it so everything in the application is confidential except to the applicant, with another exception with the reference. So I think that closes it down for anybody outside that applicant from getting anything of that application. Comments regarding that?
But let's the applicant get their own information back. And this is really important language. I mean, as it reads right now, even the applicant really doesn't have access to get documents back. And even though it says all over the applications, whatever you send us, you're not getting back. Sometimes still Julie's gotten an original life birth certificate.
Oh, geez, really?
Wow. So this language would protect the confidentiality of the application, but allow the applicant access to their own documents that they, you know.
And they can review their test and look at what they got right and wrong. Is that the idea?
Well, that would be something as well, because currently, whatever we receive, they wouldn't get back. Nothing that we receive, they can really get back.
But this language would allow that.
Yes.
Test scores aren't.
Well, as, like, look, for example, ASVAB, they release the scores to us, so we do share them with the applicants, otherwise they would never get
the scores, back. But not the actual questions and answers.
Oh, yeah.
Because they did used to do that.
Oh, wow.
When I first got registered, I could go down and take a look at my exam. And
really?
See what I got right and wrong. It was very helpful the second time.
I think a lot of, well, I know I keep saying Utah, but I'm just experiencing that one at the moment. They do come back and say which categories, you know, where you got stuff wrong, but not individual questions or anything like that. So they, like state law you missed too, or, you know, or public land stuff or whatever like that, but no, but just general.
Technically, they can request an exam review, but we can't tell them what they answered or just that they got it wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, would that be just like a recount?
Just a review.
Just to make sure they count whoever. I mean, it's all computerized now, so it's not like we're.
Well,
there's still some jurisdictions that are probably pencils.
We gave the last pencil and paper ASVAB test in October.
Wow.
And now they're going to be computer-based.
I would say review of the exams usually are in-office exams, the state-specifics.
Yeah, okay.
And those aren't going to be, like after they're done, you know, one of our staff members goes through and checks all the bubbles. There's no computer on that at all. Yeah. And they can request and pay a fee to come back and just review the questions that they had gotten wrong.
Well, anyway, I'm in agreement with that. Anyway, to like what you're saying there, it should at least, for the applicant especially, that, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
I think this language will definitely help with the public information requests, too.
Somebody would actually send in their original birth certificate?
More than once.
Really?
That's crazy.
Yes.
My goodness.
Little change in B was to scratch out registrant and put in respondent, because obviously not all cases against individuals are respondents or are registrants.
Yeah.
And we had highlighted respondent's attorney. Does that need to be put in there? Because technically, wouldn't the respondent give those to the respondent's attorney, or does it need to be said?
I like it, unless, Scott, unless you have a reason why that's not a good idea. It seems like respondent's attorney. If we're communicating with a respondent's attorney,
can we add respondent and or responding attorney?
I changed the and to the or because I didn't want it. I don't know if you can put and or.
Well, you can give it to both or one or the other. That's and or.
I mean, even if it's or, you could still get to both, right? Scott.
Yeah.
Respondent or respondent's attorney?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, you don't need to worry about the end respondent's attorney, because if respondent has an attorney and he's represented by counsel, then provision of it to respondent's attorney legally is the same as providing it to respondent.
Okay.
So you can, if he's represented by counsel, then you need to give it to the counsel anyway.
Excellent. Okay, so take it out. Sure. Perfect.
Okay. C is just to clarify that we're talking about enforcement advisory committees.
Right.
Because right now it's like a mix of what's an informal conference and advisory committee. Like, they're not the same thing, and this doesn't say it very well. So I wanted it to be clarified.
It really needed that. As we were reading that, we're like, well, what is this? It's not. They're not referring to an informal settlement conference, but it wasn't spelled out clearly.
Yeah, the list reads really well. I'm sitting on the EAC. I've been doing EACs for 30 years, and I mean, we used to actually call them. You know, they actually referred to them as hearings at one point.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, way, way, way back in the dark ages. We did those, conducted them by oil lamp.
I had scratched out this last sentence because I felt like it was somewhat redundant, because it says above that it's confidential, but you know, maybe it doesn't hurt to keep it there.
I would think it's redundant.
Yeah.
Scott, if it says at the top it's already confidential, do we need to specify that again, mm-hmm. that the board couldn't introduce confidential documents into a public meeting?
Well, that's kind of an interesting sentence because, yeah, you have to wonder why it was included, what specific situation designed to address, and while the board shouldn't be introducing confidential documents into an open session, there may have come a time at one point where the board felt they couldn't discuss the case itself in open session, and so this may have been put in specifically to provide legal cover for an exclusion for the board to discuss matters being reviewed by the committee, so long as they're not discussing the confidential documents, because otherwise it may hamstring the board in its ability to actually dispose of the case in an open session.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. We should leave that.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure.
E and F are additional exceptions. So we have obviously verifications. Other states request verifications be sent to them when someone's applying in another state. Hey, are they currently active here in Arizona? There's technically nothing saying that we can share that with them. And same thing with the national councils. And so this is kind of just opened up that, yes, we are allowed to do that. There, you know, somewhat of an assumption that we can share those, and we receive verifications from other states as well when people are applying here.
Yeah.
But we just want to make sure that it's clear that it's, you know, allowed.
Applicant, other regulatory agencies. Yeah.
And F kind of also helps us with, there are certain circumstances where we can't really move forward with a case. It's still technically open, and it's not final as you would say above here on B. So if I can
set
a final hearing, or yes, yeah, settled by consent order. Sometimes It's just open. Nothing's going on with it, and it's still considered open, and therefore we can't really proceed by moving it to, say, a prosecutor's office.
If it's something that needs to go, information to a law enforcement agency or for a criminal prosecution.
For example, we had cases that the board had voted to send to the Attorney General's office for a prosecution. It got there, and they said, we would like an investigator to
provide all the documents.
Provide the documents and also be a witness, but it was technically still confidential because it hadn't been finalized yet. Because
it was administratively still open.
Oh, okay.
So
we wanted to be able to make sure that if the board chooses to go that route, it's not hamstringed by the confidentiality to proceed how it voted to proceed to get information.
This brings up another thought on the disciplinary side, and that is, NCARB has a disciplinary database, and I don't see anything here that allows us to share disciplinary action with NCARB. And generally, that's shared with NCARB once it's fully executed, once it's settled.
Final.
Once it's final, yeah.
I would say that this doesn't exclude that because it's finalized, and then we let NCARB
know. Then it's public record.
But if it's not finalized, you would not.
NCARB doesn't want it if it's not finalized.
Right.
Correct. So I don't see an issue because it would be finalized before NCARB got it. And it becomes totally public. We put it on our website at that time as well.
Okay.
What's the purpose of including another state in F?
So if someone... if I am renewing in New Mexico and I have an open case against me, and I have to disclose on my renewal that I have an open case against me in New Mexico, New Mexico may ask
for the paperwork.
As a condition of my renewal, may say, we want to know what's going on in Arizona. Even though I'm required to give them the details of what's going on, they may go, that Ed Marley, he's not, you can't trust that guy. And so then they would ask the board for additional information. That's why we need to be able to disclose.
Yeah, and most of the professionals are registered in multiple states' jurisdictions.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions?
Just in summary, So open cases can be disclosed to agencies, other states, attorney generals, law enforcement, and the applicant himself, right? That's what this chapter is telling us?
Well, F would be all the disciplinary, as you had said, the first three, but then the applicants, that's different. That would be under D for their application. However, a respondent would usually be privy to most items of an investigation under B that's listed there.
All right. And that's it. Other than that, everyone has to wait for a final
correct
analysis. I'm good with that.
Any others?
You good?
I think that's going to be great.
We had a pretty interesting discussion last time about the firms and branches. Hayden has provided some information regarding firms and branches just recently. I haven't really had time to really, really, really dive into it, but I can still provide a quick look at it with you guys in a second.
They said mostly like the memo and the things from City of Phoenix.
I had a question on this last time, and I don't know if my mute was on or nothing, but I might have just been talking to myself. On our firm, the listing in there, you go in there and it lists, like my firm, and it, at one point it used to list who the responsible registrants were, but that's not on there anymore. Is it still on the form?
That's a technical issue. Basically, how our database works is that it does allow us to download them all together, matching the principal. And actually, there's quite a few missing things. And that's a problem with that is that we were on one database that we went on in 2013, tried to go into GL Solutions in 2016, came off of GL Solutions, had two new databases that we had to migrate together in 2019, and what you end up with is some little, I guess you would say, cuts in the line between some of these. Even though we know who the principal is and we enter that in, when we run our reports, it doesn't list the principal. It just leaves it all blank.
Even if there's like a different registrant, would be like a different office, or is it just all the principal numbers? I mean, I've worked places where our Phoenix office has its registrants that are responsible charge, and then you have office number two or they're one, and they're responsible registrants.
If the database itself will connect it, staff will get the firm registrations and renewals, and they'll basically connect, make that connection into the database. The problem is that when we run the report, it doesn't list those principals. For whatever reason, it just remains blank without having the information available. That when we do our upload to the website, we don't have that principal to share.
Okay.
But if somebody were to ask, they could call us and we'd be able to give it to them right away.
But with our new online platform, we should be able to link it.
Correct. That's moving forward right now. It's not working. It's a different thing outside of this, but just know, fingers crossed, we'll be good to go by the end of this fiscal year. I'm sharing with you just information that I got from Hayden here just yesterday, some of the things he was looking at his other states and what they do. So, let's see, there's a bit more to, let's say, this Architect Board of Oregon, where you have to provide like a lot more documentation about what kind of company it is and how many people have to be. Hayden, do you have a quick synopsis that you got from?
These ones were, a lot of them were broken up by these ones, like corporations, LLCs, partnerships, and a lot of them kind of overlap, but there's some, like on the first, so I didn't see. So the rest are all engineering.
You're going really fast.
I know. He said there might be others. I just, like Minnesota doesn't have those broken down.
So I'll still have to look more into the branches and disciplines for.
Well, just for the firm stuff is.
It seems like they've created the breakdowns to alleviate confusion when people are registering firms. So the different kinds of corporation partnerships, limited liability, all those kind of things like that. They've got those states that have spelled out what you have to provide. That sure helps on the back end, our end, to know what needs to be gathered or not.
So obviously this would be an example of firm registration with far more teeth, as we were talking about last time.
Was that Texas? What are we looking at?
New York.
I mean, we can look at any states, but I always tend to start looking at my neighbors first, like Western
Oregon.
Zone.
We had Oregon up there.
Yeah. Texas, Oregon, New Mexico, Washington, I don't know, kind of Western Zone-ish. I hesitate to say California sometimes. You never know.
I don't see anything about sole proprietorship in any of these. It might be nice, but I think those are people who usually be dinged more than anybody else, but if they just don't understand that they need the firm registration if they're a sole proprietor.
Right.
But just, I guess, food for thought. And what we have currently, the language that you guys reviewed last time, is us kind of claim to clarify things, but after we got this information, it kind of begs the question, does our language even go far enough that staff has provided, or should it be, a lot more like this, where we're asking for their...
This seems like overkill to me.
I don't know, I think there needs to be a little bit more of a happy medium from what we have. I'm not looking for overkill, but something that makes it a little bit clearer what should be provided.
The way we left it last time was considering eliminating firm registration.
It was on the table.
Remember, that was Dr. Angel's suggestion.
I think it was just a thought, but I don't. That's definitely not the. I don't know that that's the best way to go. If the whole nation didn't do it, you might be questioning why they're doing it. If we didn't do it, we'd definitely be in the minority. Most states are doing it. And as you can see, doing a lot more than we're doing. So.
You don't want to look at New York and New Jersey.
No, no. That's why I said I tend to look more in our own neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think Oregon simplified theirs over the years. When I initially got licensed in Oregon back in 2000, I think it was. Obviously, I'm a director in the corporation, so I met all their criteria, except we had to actually file a DBA because our firm name is Swaim Associates Architects, plural, and their interpretation was you had to have more than one registrant in Oregon to use plural architects.
Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty nifty.
Wow.
So I think they've changed it.
So we don't want to go to either one of the coasts.
Go back to the Oregon example.
There is one that said...
That was the first one we were looking at.
I can't remember if it was Oregon, but there is one that's the same, like the firm can't use the term engineering at all unless there's at least one engineer, either the director or the member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you just had that one. I was just...
Yeah.
Is this Oregon?
This is Oregon architect.
Yeah, if you say you're an engineering firm, you got to have an engineer. If you say you're engineering land surveying, you got to have both. But, I read it there when you were flipping through them there at some point.
Yeah, that's language
that
we seems like it makes sense to have.
But, I mean, it's kind of a given. I mean, you can't do practice land surveying.
But it's not a given in the current language we have. That's what's a little bit frightening to me. Like,
currently, you can be any registrant.
Any registrant.
And then be the principal of an engineering firm as a home inspector or something.
I like that.
I don't know if you want that responsibility. I don't think I would. I mean, if we're protecting the public, that doesn't... I mean, you know, as Joe Q Public... If I'm reaching out to an architectural firm, I'm going to assume...
You know why I talked to
there's an architect working
How
there.
You currently, isn't there an exemption? So, like, if you're a sole proprietor, you don't have to have firm registration?
No, it's the very specific
for everything, everything now.
Sole proprietor.
I know that was a conversation. It's been years that we talked about that one. That was because, you know, you have... Probably more, well, I don't know, there's probably quite a few architects out there that just work on their own that don't have, you know. I know there's obviously a lot more surveyors probably that do that, and I imagine, well, pretty much every one of your guys would be, so.
Yeah. Not all of them. We don't have sole proprietor up here.
Well, this is Oregon.
Do they have it anywhere else? I mean, most of them are LLCs, but... But then they're no longer sole proprietors. No, they don't seem to have any sole proprietor regulations up there.
I don't think I saw any.
Hmm?
I don't think I saw any on any of these ones here.
Well, and it may be that their statutes are very basic. When it comes to sole proprietor, you need to have a firm registration. The rest of these are like, okay,
what you have to provide.
If A equals B, go to F and all of this because you got five directors
right.
that are engineers and four that are architects, and so now you got to, you know,
right.
it gets more complicated.
Right. Well, it wouldn't be a big deal if you were a surveyor or an engineer and you were working out of your garage. Exactly.
You're
everybody.
Out of your garage. You're the firm.
Yeah.
And you register.
Right.
We can have Hayden go back to these states where he pulled this information and check to see if that's the case, that there's sole proprietor's responsibility, but not
and I'll
providing
look more at states
all those.
And what would be interesting is to look at multidiscipline board states.
I don't know that there's another one that's like this board.
Kansas, Minnesota. They're both multidisciplinary.
Yep. Larry from Kansas. And Dory from Minnesota.
Minnesota. Those two, I know right off the top of my head, are multidisciplinary boards.
But even though Doreen's multidisciplinary, I think they're multiple. I mean, she is multidisciplinary too, but I think she has more than one board that she's the executive director for.
She is, but the Minnesota board, their acronym is this long.
Yeah.
It's the Minnesota Board of Architects, Engineers, Land Surveyors, Interior Designers,
Geologists, too.
Geologists, and landscape architects.
I think she's the
architects.
Only one that I see.
Oh, that is that right?
That I know.
Seriously.
You got longer.
I'm
yeah,
registered in
the only reason I know that is because those are the couple of faces I see at all of the conferences, you know?
So what was our proposal? You didn't make one?
Well, we don't. We're still doing homework on it. So we're just sharing with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Minnesota Board of AELSLAGID.
Oh, that's
cool. I'm kind of liking board.
Just rolls right off the tongue.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good to me.
Oh, my gosh.
You could be a hero and suggest that in Minnesota. Have them go to a BTR.
They need a BTR.
Architecture, engineering, land surveying, landscape architecture, geoscience, and interior design.
So they even have interior design.
Yeah.
We're missing that one.
So how are we leaning on this?
I don't think we have an idea yet.
No, I think we're still trying to figure out a best path. And doing the back end work to try to make it.
So you're not going to try to change that this year?
I would say that this next session probably not this
time
around.
I don't know. Yeah.
Table this for down the road.
And the whole purpose for the firm registration is?
I think that's the key question. To narrow it, why are we doing this?
Well, I know, like, in Nevada had firm registration because at one point you had to, in order to have a firm there and practice there, you had to have a brick-and-mortar office in Nevada. Mm-hmm. They have repealed that now where you don't have to have that.
They still have it. They still have the registration requirement because, at least for architects, two-thirds of the corporate ownership has to be licensed in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So right now,
I'm
at the point in my stock ownership that there need to be three of us to be to get licensed in Nevada to meet the two-thirds requirement because we kind of don't.
So do you think
stock.
That's to prevent businesses that are, say, based out of, New Jersey from claiming to be a Nevada architect firm, or
I have no idea.
So here's kind of an example: like our company, the parent company of us is based in California, and we're 275 people. Here in Arizona, I've got about 40 in our subsidiary branch, different name. And we were, prior to them purchasing us, we were a separate LLC. Now we're not; we're part of these other guys. So, how would that affect us being, working in the state?
I don't know, because it's firm and branch registration, so your branch is still registered separately, isn't it, from the firm?
I don't even know.
That's right. I
got confused.
I did it one time, but it's been years since I had invested that.
It was easier when we were just us, but now that we're
point would be that are the directors of your company licensed?
And
see, that's what I'm saying.
Not in Arizona.
Yeah,
no.
Then you wouldn't meet that criteria for that.
I'm on the board, but I'm the only one on the board from Arizona. So everybody else is in other states.
We don't have that requirement to have.
No, right, but I'm just saying
you
could go down this path and there's a million different, permutations.
These here seem to be dealing with ownership.
I know, and that's
two-thirds
what
it is. Of ownership.
That to me goes a step too far.
And that's why I asked what is the purpose of the firm registration?
Yeah.
Because we don't.
How are we protecting the public by registering the firm?
We enforce against the individual, the registrant.
We can enforce against firms, but then it also falls to whoever the responsible professional is.
Right.
put under the professional conduct rule.
And we've had cases where we had to ding the local guy from a larger firm, and it wasn't fair because he doesn't write checks.
Right.
And it was usually a non-payment or collaborating professional issue, and we would go out, we would pursue the firm, and we would...
That's how the conversation started.
Yeah, yeah. I remember that.
We go, okay, well, the local architect who has zero ability over the financial affairs of his company...
Or even decision...
...has a mark on his record now because his firm didn't do what they were supposed to do and pay a collaborative professional. I'm not sure that that's right.
So maybe it's the structure of what, I mean, I think the bottom line is because it's something that's offering to the public professional services regulated by the board. It's a business that's offering professional services regulated by the board. So if you didn't have it.
So I'm wondering, okay, so
does that free up anybody to...
There's an accountant firm. If the accountancy board has firm registration.
Ooh, just, yeah, Scott would know that.
I'm just looking for parallels to what we're doing.
I think I even have it on that one from Arizona boards.
Oh, which ones?
For accountancy, for their firm
really?
Registration.
Oh, cool. That's
okay. So
let me get down to the states then.
Physical therapy.
It's not too much, but that's...
Oh, it's like a spill on form.
I like that.
Wow. That's kind of what we already have.
He is a little high, but I like that.
That was definitely just about money.
That would work for me.
Well, but they are accountants.
So the difference, like, I mean, I can tell you because the next one's funeral director. So barber and cosmetology and funeral directors, their businesses have a license and they are inspected physically. Mm-hmm. You know.
That's why I didn't pick medical.
So that's different.
Weird accountancy seem more
like... Dispensing opticians are inspected. They all have sole proprietor. Dental, so they have a registration. They're not, their physical places aren't inspected. They have, but they've got business entity registration. So I think like the substantial businesses that are offering services to the public, regulated by the board. I think they have. It looks like they have some kind of registration or some accountability.
Why do we want to complicate it? Stop by that board of accountancy. Let's go that route.
That's where we're at. Only less money and annually instead of every 2 years.
So less money is good. There was one there that said pay $100 a year but only register every third year. I think that was dental, maybe. I'm not sure.
Yeah, maybe that, maybe there's some things we can do to simplify. I feel like we're kind of overcomplicating this, and I think part of the concern around this table, my perspective, is we're penalizing people who have no control over what their overall corporation might do.
But in the past, we've always waived, at least when I was there, we always waived it if you didn't have any control. But
I remember one poor guy that got a letter of reprimand out of it, but that was only one. We were a meaner board after you left.
Yeah, I know.
You couldn't have been any meaner than when Stuart was there, so.
So,
I'm not opposed to it. I was just
Well, Ed, how do you make somebody responsible that isn't? I mean, you're saying who's currently responsible shouldn't be responsible, or how would we fix that? I don't know.
It would be whoever seals on the document.
Well, the problem is there's a lot of offices, let's say AECOM, they have an office here. Maybe their local people aren't aren't corporate directors or shareholders in the company right. or anything like that. They're sealing documents, but they have no... I'm always looking at it because what started the whole firm registration thing was when we put in the statute non-payment of a collaborating professional. We needed a mechanism because that's more of a firm-driven thing. It wasn't actually a health, safety, and welfare protection of the public thing necessarily other than protecting consultants, which was fine.
Well, it's also an ethics thing, too.
And it's an ethics thing, exactly. I think we need to, and I think this is why we need more research, we need to figure out, okay, how do we get someone who has that kind of authority to be the
responsible registrant
in the state so that's who this gets attached to rather than
some of those are like that because they say that the board of directors has to have three and then you'd be going after those guys.
Yeah.
It may be why some of those states have those really restrictive guidelines to that stuff to accommodate for that and not.
Can somebody just write down what purpose of the firm registration is and what are the consequences for it, because I still don't understand it. And that from that, then you can decide, well, what makes sense in the statute?
Or there should be a mechanism to be able to go after the firm as an entity,
a financial thing where, in our case of my company, all the money that we generate is in a bank in California. It's not sitting here. So I don't know what that means, but...
I mean, right now we go after registrants. And so that we're trying to get registrants in as firm principals. Maybe we need a mechanism to go after firms as well as registrants.
What's the professional conduct rule is what kind of connects the two. And it just says it... the registrant who is designated as a responsible registrant shall be responsible for the firm or corporation. The board may impose disciplinary action on the responsible registrant for any violation of the board statutes or rules that is committed by a non-registrant employee, firm, or corporation.
Has the board ever gone after a company, a firm?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're usually always... dual respondents, basically, in the same investigation.
Yeah. It's whoever's on the firm card and the firm.
Okay.
Yes.
And to another point, why sole proprietorship is there is because of actually the statute's definition of firm. Firm means any individual or partnership, corporation, or other type of association, including the association of a non-registrant and a registrant, who offers to the public professional services regulated by the board. Maybe scratching individual may leave us a simplifier.
All right. Well, I guess, additional research if you want it, and then we can just address your highlighted one and maybe, because I don't think we're going to solve it.
No,
we're not going to solve that right now.
We got still got a lot to cover.
But we still got to address, do we want in good standing with the board? Is that the one?
Well, I think maybe we just table the whole
thing.
Firm registration.
Yeah. I agree.
Table 32141 firm. Right.
So next time we meet, we'll have forgotten this whole conversation.
No. We won't because we meet in between and try to help get things in place to help this meeting go as smooth as possible. Where are we at in the document now?
Down to C2 on
page 30.
Limitations.
I think you're down to C2 on 32144.
Exceptions, limitations. I don't think anything's changed there. Nothing's changed there. Violations. No. Since we've discussed in the past. Okay, I think that's the end of the statute. I think we hit all the points that I was looking for.
Okay.
What's everyone's time? Let's say that. Does anybody have to be leaving fairly soon?
I have to leave by about 2:30, quarter three. I got to get to the airport.
Okay, so we have an hour.
I have to leave about 2.
Oh, we have that's 15 minutes.
Well, still have a quorum. Yeah. We have 4.
Did you want to look at policy statements, Kurt, or was there something else?
The only thing I would say is Ed had pointed out something in the rule that he would like us to look at.
Okay, right. Okay.
So let me.
Who was that? I can't remember.
It's a 5-year rolling clock.
Yeah. Is it 204?
Oh, right. How could I forget the rolling clock?
Yeah, we haven't talked about any of the things that staff's been thinking about with rules and such, but
I don't think we're going to be able to get into
that's
that.
That's fine, but it was this number 6 here, which is currently under examinations. The board shall close an examination authorization file for multi-divisional national examinations if the applicant fails to pass all divisions of the applicable examination within 5 years after first passing any division of the examination unless the board approves an extension.
So at NCARB, we've started the discussion about NCARB has a five-year rolling clock. It's not as restrictive as this one. It's just if you don't keep passing exams, then some of the older ones do drop off. But this one, you lose. You don't pass it all, you lose it all. So
is that really what happens?
Well, that's what I'm reading here. It says, shall close an examination authorization file for multi-divisional if the applicant fails to pass all divisions within 5 years. So, ARE, 6-part exam. Well, I start taking them and I take 4 of them, or 5, and then I just can't pass that 6th one and I roll past that 5-year. The way I read this is,
you lost it all.
Unless I convince the board to extend.
I don't think
they would lose it. They would have to submit a new application to get further authorization take that last.
So I guess my question. Okay, so maybe that's how this.
I don't think the other exams would just fall through the cracks.
I guess what I'm asking is, why do they need to reapply? It's
more about having the back end date on it. Because if you don't have something, Ed, then what they apply to take an exam and it's open.
20 years, 30
mm. years. I mean, there's never a closure on it. And so,
I don't know. I think that's fair. What's up there? I mean, like you said, I've witnessed and what usually if they ask for an extension, I don't know that you guys would. I don't think it would have to be really something that you would say no. You just can't have that. No,
I can give only maybe one example, and that would be when someone's had the fundamentals waived. And then they have failed a professional a number of times, and they just want more time. And we just, we want you to go back and do the fundamentals.
But still, that's not going to affect your NC's record. That's just going to affect you resubmitting your application here.
We don't have to touch this right now. It's just I just want everybody to be aware that NCARB is dealing with the rolling clock on our end as well. And I want to make sure that we're.
I think it's just the application because NCARB they're not. Making anybody's test scores disappear, like say they pass 3 of the 6 sections, and NCARB gives them an extension or whatever.
One. That's why we're having a discussion. Discussions. They could. Exams could drop off, and we're going why.
Most everybody's only got 2 then. I mean, it's just a special case there, obviously.
The architects were overachieving. More
they've got 6, LAs have 4, and the engineers are 1 except for structurals, which are going to go from 2 to 4 sections because they're going computer-based. It used to be 2 16, or was it 16 hours?
But you're still talking about 1 exam, but different sections of the exam.
Yeah, that they can take independently.
Well, yeah, with a 16-hour exam, my God.
It used to be 2 8-hour days.
When I took the ARE, we had a 12-hour building design exam.
Oh my gosh.
Locked in. We started at 5:30 a.m. and finished at 5:30 p.m.
Wow.
Yeah, we just did the whole building.
8 hours is a tough. I mean, it was.
It hurt, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even a 6.
Even
hour.
6, you know, because the surveyors are 6 and 8, but I mean, that whole day in there is brutal.
We're in discussions about why do we even put a time limit on how long somebody has to take a particular exam. If they can you know, if they need more than 4 hours, why? It's kind of an artificial constraint, what we're looking at. So we're talking about the reason to just eliminate that. Maybe there's a block of time you set aside, and then you have to, you can pay for additional time if you want to.
Yeah.
It'll take you longer or something.
To extend, yeah.
Because it'll be a scheduling nightmare.
We do have the exception for geologists if they want to take the fundamentals and the professional exam on the same day.
So 4 hours each.
So we can leave that alone.
General contractors in California, and I took that exam. With the 2 8-hour exams.
With the 40 minutes we have left, it's kind of hard to tackle both the remaining.
Yes. Do we want to just go and I think we could cruise through a lot of these substantive policies.
Let's do that. Yeah. Let's look at, oh, we've got 10 minutes with Mr. Stanley. Is there one particular to engineering that...
Where they at?
Is that in the
same packet?
Yeah, it should be in the bottom of it. Yeah.
It's, let's see here.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go. It is the very bottom. Yeah.
There we go. Pass the seals.
Just as a point of order there, Judith, on a substantive policy statement, is that generally come out of a request from the board only because there's an enforcement case or something that they feel is unclear, or can something like that be presented to the board to review?
Right. That's how we did it from home inspectors. We developed a substantive policy statement in the Rules and Standards Committee and send it to the board for approval.
Okay.
So I haven't seen it work like that before, but again, this board's unique in the fact that there's no home inspector on the board to instigate that, so
right.
I could see that happening.
My experience is also the L&R committee is actually the ones who've recommended.
The ones I've been involved with, you know, if you go back to when Stuart was on the board, were all stemmed out of some enforcement case that, you know, somebody tried to...
That's right. Yeah. They come from a problem.
Right. The problem, and Scott, you can interrupt me anytime you want. I mean, I cringed when I saw how many policy statements there were in place here. I see that as absolutely frightening, and I don't like it, and a lot of them are so old. And when you say it stemmed from an enforcement issue, the problem is that that's something that's advisory only. These are advisory statements, but people see them and they take them as law. And that's and each individual enforcement case that comes to the board should be evaluated by the board at that time and dealt with at that time. But when you put these policy statements out there, and then again, advisory only, but people cling to them like it's hard and fast law that they can hang their hat on, and you can't. To me, that just creates a lot of problems.
Right. Well, specifically like the one for recording and monument interest subdivisions. You know, that stemmed from the fact that we had surveyors that were, and I felt mine was one of the fun ones that was, the developer went bankrupt. He did not keep the subdivision plat in the bank. Bankruptcy. He let it go back to the bank. This is 2008, 2009. The bank that he was financed through went bankrupt. The subdivision was in limbo. There was recorded documents and plats, and they were building. They had, because in Mojave County, you can build at risk, and you have a plat that's not approved, not sealed, or it was sealed by me, but there's no monuments on the ground because we haven't even gotten to that phase yet. It was kind of an interesting, which is where that one stemmed out of. Because
that was during like a nightmare recession period. Really unique situation.
Yeah, it was. And later, the developer went to prison for fraud anyway, so that was a different issue.
Good example.
My point in that was, I mean, there was a reason for that, because at that time it was determined that we know that legally the plat is authoritative. That's it. That's what it is. So if the whole thing stemmed around original monumentation. If, you know, somebody else comes in and monuments it, but his seal was not on there. So it was really kind of a unique situation that really needed to be explained to people that they... How to handle that. So even though that's an older one, you know, I don't know that, like I said, the ones I've been involved in, even though they're, like you said, they're, I understand what you're saying, is they're not the law, but they reflect what the rules and the laws are for clarification.
What the board in place at that moment interpreted the laws and rules to be.
True. Yeah.
Which might not be the same if the same scenario came now. So again, it just makes me really uneasy.
Aren't they intended to actually morph into rule?
If it's something that's that important, that's coming up so much that it's chronically an issue, yeah. Law or rule, yes. Scott, you jump in on that anytime you want, or Mr. Stanley.
Well, at the end of the day, a substantive policy statement is just purely designed as guidance from a board as to what their thinking is on a particular interpretation of a rule or statute at a certain moment in time. And so to a certain degree, it gives guidance to practitioners. The problem is that Judy is absolutely right in that they are advisory only. They're guidance only. And you could have a board, if you have two board members, three board members change over, when a case actually gets in front of the board, they could be interpreting the statute differently at that time. So an advisory substantive policy statement is just a statement by the board that at that moment they're interpreting a rule or a statute in a certain way. And it from a legal standpoint, it gets dangerous when they're not revised for a period of time because things change, people on the board change, circumstances outside of the board change. And so they really should be revised periodically to make sure that they actually do reflect on some level some degree of practical guidance that's still applicable. But they are not law. They are not rule. It certainly could be a defense for somebody if they get into court that they relied on a substantive policy statement. But at the end of the day, it's not a law or a rule, and they would likely lose.
So on the ones that, let's say we review these and we feel that, yeah, this is still in effect or still needs to be looked at, those can go back to the board to get a revision date on the policy statement or to maybe the board doesn't agree and rescinds it or something like that, but that would put a new date on it?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be putting a new date on it. It would be simply recommending to the board whether they would need to revoke a policy statement, which can be revoked by the board at any time, or revised. If it's as it stands, if the policy statement is 100% still a reflection of appropriate guidance for interpretation of a statute or rule, it doesn't have to be changed. It wouldn't need to be reissued with a new date. But if it didn't any longer reflect accurate guidance, then a recommendation could be made to the board to either rescind the policy statement or modify it.
It's okay if you haven't, but I'm just going to throw it out there. Has anyone had an opportunity to really look at these policy statements? I know you've got a lot to look at, so it's okay. You want to look at me and give me the stink eye. Okay.
I wasn't.
Okay.
I have, and actually I was involved in several of these over the years, and so I can give a little history on them, and then we can decide. Like, we'll just start with this one. This one was done in 1997. It was because plan reviewers in a lot of municipalities were requesting registrants to make changes to their documents because it's just something they wanted. It had no basis in code. They were requiring design professionals to change their professional documents counter to their professional judgment. And the industry got, both engineers and architects got frustrated with it. And I was the AIA Government Affairs Chair at the time. I worked with the board to come up with this language. So what did the building officials industry do? This is from the 2018 International Building Code, section 107.2.1, information on construction documents. Construction documents shall be dimensioned and drawn on suitable material. Electronic media documents are permitted to be submitted where approved by the building official. Construction documents shall be of sufficient clarity to indicate the location, nature, and extent of the work proposed, and show in detail that it will conform to the provisions of this code and relevant laws, ordinances, rules, and regulations, keywords here, as determined by the building official. So basically, if they want me to put something on my documents and I don't agree with them, they cite this section because this substantive policy statement said you have to cite chapter and verse to back up what you're requiring the registrant to change. So what they did was they said, well, per 107.2.1, we are requiring you to make this change. So it's kind of become a moot point. I don't know that we need this anymore. My colleagues may disagree. I like the idea of requiring code officials to cite the chapter and verse of the changes they want made or the comment that they have on my documents. It makes my job a lot easier. So that provision I really like, but overall, they very brilliantly engineered a workaround.
A workaround, yep, a loophole.
Yep, because I'm sure we're not the only state that has hammered them about this.
So this oldest policy statement that we have, we could recommend to be rescinded.
I think so. I said a lot of my colleagues may disagree, but you know what? They're not here.
It's not something that really affects land surveying that much. Yeah. So, I mean, it was certainly the engineers and you guys. You know.
Architects, for sure.
Mr. Yeah. Stanley, what are your thoughts in 1 minute?
Well, on this one, I think it's, you know, like you said, it goes away. Although I have, in the 90s and early aughts, it was real common. That hasn't been a lot of pushback from building departments lately.
I haven't seen that either. Things. That's why I'm thinking it's old.
Yeah, it's old. It could be gone away.
Yep.
Excellent.
That's an easy one.
I mean, if they don't cite a code chapter and verse, they don't come back and say, well, you have to do this just because I say so.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to number two.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley. And Mr. Stanley, did you need to leave it too, just so we have it for the record? Did you need to leave it 2 o'clock, or did I misunderstand?
Yes, I do. I was just getting ready to type in. I'm going to jump.
Okay. So.
I have another meeting I have to get to. That's
okay.
All.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. I'm not Mr. Stanley. I'm Bob. Mr. Stanley is my father, and he's been gone for a while.
Thanks,
so.
Bob. I get caught up in the formalities sometimes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Number two, interpretation total cost of such construction. We actually made this go away when we changed wastewater treatment from a dollar value to a capacity.
We still have a dollar value, and it's a huge problem.
It's proposed.
Well, it's proposed. So this could, yeah. I think we can keep this as it is for now, and then hopefully that provision does get changed, and then this can go away.
Mm-hmm. We're going to need some help on that. I don't know how, but Kurt's reached out twice to the gentleman that came to the board when we discussed this.
I reached out to a number of people. I'm getting any response whatsoever.
We're getting no responses back.
Who are you reaching out to?
So ADQ, a gentleman named Mr. Worth, who basically was very opinionated during those discussions and sent us a lot of information. And I believe he's the president of kind of like the Wastewater Engineer Association or whatever it might be. But neither of them have... I'm trying to get a hold of Mr. Worth because he seemed to be very much... That was his kind of thing.
Because we were trying to... I think we were throwing out like a 3,200-gallon capacity or something like that.
Right. It was... what are the gallons per minute?
3,000
gallons.
We checked
that really briefly.
Yeah, it was gallons per minute.
Gallons per day.
Gallons per day.
It was 3,000 or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It makes sense to change it. So, I mean, regardless of what feedback you get, Having a dollar amount doesn't make any sense if it's
$12,000 from get the backhoe on site to dig
it
out.
But we can just dump this when the new rules come in, right?
Yeah. When the new.
And it should stay in place until
then.
Yeah,
it's the wastewater. So a non-res designs a water wastewater treatment plant or extension.
It's one of the exemptions.
It's just saying it is design and construction. It doesn't include all the other things. That's what the question was, right?
Okay, so how about for the next meeting, part of our homework, we'll come back with a proposed revised ARS 32144A6 about the wastewater.
Yeah.
We'll throw something out, and you guys...
Okay.
Let us know what you think, and we'll do our best to try to get some more feedback.
I'll reach out to a couple of engineers I know in Tucson that design wastewater systems.
Oh, thank you.
See if they,
thank
This problem came from another board, didn't it? This came from
the discussions that we had with the ADQ.
Right.
Brought it up because they are changing some of their rules.
Yeah, they brought it up because they were questioning modifications to systems.
I think
remember?
They were having troubles. Was there a conflict in the county?
Well, there was a modification to a system where they needed to know whether it included the cost of the entire system or just the cost of the modification.
That was one issue. Yeah, I do remember that.
There's a lot of questions.
There was.
And they were all looking to us for the answer. And now we're going to go back and look to them for the answer.
Well, I mean, I think we all understand there needs to be a statutory change.
Yes.
Definitely. But what that is the thing that we can't seem to get out of.
And not to exceed $12 million.
I mean, we know having a dollar amount is a bad way to go. Because...
Right.
The law is there for the next 30 years. Obviously, that's not going to be a good fit. So, okay.
Yep.
So we'll come back with a proposal
number
for that
three.
One.
I remember this one being drafted. I don't remember why. So I don't have background on this one. But I just don't know that it's an issue anymore.
I think this is probably another one that should be rescinded.
I would tend to agree. I mean, it's
20 years old.
It's 20 years old, and it's basically stating what goes on in the industry anyway.
By now, the codes have probably been changed multiple times.
Codes have been changed.
And aren't they pretty specific to different cities? I mean, they have their own.
They are. A lot of cities have, a lot of fire alarm systems. If you have NICET certification, you can do a fire alarm system design. In a lot of jurisdictions, and they know more than an electrical engineer knows about designing a fire alarm system. So, and basically, that's what this says. I don't say a whole lot.
No, I agree.
So, recommend this one.
So, I'd say
to rescind.
I'd recommend rescinding that one.
Boy, that's a pretty big statement.
Number four, ceiling of standard detail. So, this is one of those common sense things. We did have, this one came up because someone submitted a set of documents to, I think it might have even been the city of Phoenix. I can't remember when this one was adopted, 2002, so it's 20 years old as well. It submitted a set of documents to the city of Phoenix, and they didn't seal sheets that were composed of standard engineering details from MAG, from Maricopa Association of Governments. They had them on the sheet rather than just referencing them, but they didn't seal that sheet. And City of Phoenix was trying to force them to seal them, and they're just like, no, I'm not the engineer worker. I didn't design these details. These are what you require. And so I'm not sure how that all played out, but we came up with this statement that says you do not have to seal standard details. I mean, I include UL fire rated assembly details in my drawings.
I have a note that I put on there that says not designed by architect of record, and I don't see an issue. And same thing happens, standard manhole details, things like that, curb details, whatever MAG or PAG or whoever is the authority having jurisdiction has on the project. So you just put a note on there that says, didn't design these details, therefore they're exempt from a registered seal. I don't know that we need this.
So part of what I don't feel comfortable with on this one, and thank you, Ed, for that explanation, and that makes perfect sense to me, but in the second paragraph of the policy statement, when it refers to that we're not prepared by the registrant or their bona fide employee, anywhere that bona fide employee thing comes back in, especially in a policy statement, it makes me go, oh. Because that ends up...
Well, I don't know why we put bona fide employee in there, because everything falls to the registrant, so
and
you don't
whole,
need to reference
right.
bona fide employee. So if we want to leave this one in there, I would recommend you strike that and just say not prepared by the registrant. End of story.
You feel like this one needs to stay?
I don't know. I'm just...
Well, put a question mark on that one.
Put a question mark. I don't know.
Because I'm leaning towards no, but I don't. Orlane, what would be your opinion as you read this one? I mean, documents are sealed. I mean, is this?
So here's. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah.
Well, if it's the professional documents, if they're not, it kind of well, can't talk about it. In case, but
hypothetically,
yeah. It's if a professional puts their seal on a document, it becomes a professional document. Therefore, they have to respond to whatever's on there. They have that responsibility.
And so, the city's forcing them to put their seal, or you know. In theory, forcing somebody to put their seal on a page of codes that is adopted by the
standard
municipality or whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, how is this policy statement? I mean, is that really what they need other than for the individual to say, I can't seal that document. I didn't have anything to do with those codes or adopted whatever.
Well, the most rudimentary example would be most municipalities or Maricopa Association of Governments, FEMA Association of Governments have standard details like for a manhole. And it's going to be, they want the base to look like this, they want the collars, the taper cone, the manhole ring, all of that, and all of that's engineered by somebody. Who knows? MAG or PAG hired an engineer, they had an in-house engineer these things, and they're all... And so I put that detail on my drawings, or my civil engineer puts that detail on their drawings. Well, if the minute they seal that, they're responsible. If that manhole fails because of an engineering defect, that civil engineer could be on the hook for that failure, even though he didn't engineer it. So the prudent thing to do is put a disclaimer on there that goes standard county detail, not engineered by engineer of record, and then you don't seal it.
Again, perfectly logical. So,
so it's perfectly logical. It makes sense to us as registrants, and I don't think I think this is more for the reviewing community to understand how our statutes work, and how you know the use of seals works.
But
versus,
is this something that should be put in statute under use of seals?
I would say either put this or in rule.
Because it's not.
Maybe we take this might be a really good example to take out and put in rule for use of seal, because isn't use of seals 430 whatever?
It's avoid, 304. Yes.
Yeah, so if it's in rule, let's put it in rule and
okay.
Let's clarify that registrants shall not seal standard details, or you know, I mean, the problem is we'll have to craft that language carefully, because
right.
I put sheets in my document sent from other non-regulated professions, food service designers, I don't steal their work because I didn't design it. But they're just laying out, I mean, it's a diagram showing kitchen equipment. So the engineering part of it is handled by my engineer. So all the plumbing connections, all the electrical connections, everything that is a health, safety, and welfare issue is addressed by a registrar, but I don't seal their drawing. I don't seal...
But they're incorporated into the drawings. So
they're in the drawing set that goes out.
So you almost need like an appendix or something that has...
we'll put those at the back of the set. Mm-hmm. And then we put that same clarifying statement on there says...
You got to help us think that through.
Yeah.
Well, the meat of this would be the second paragraph in the substantive policy statement that says it's the responsibility of the registrant to clarify or disclaim these portions.
And that's what needs... I think that's what needs to be put in the rule. I think we get this out of... That way it's...
Yeah.
It actually will then have more force of power... Four municipalities
that are
required. Because this
really has no force of power. Just keep reminding us.
I mean, if you don't mind, can I jump in for just a second?
Absolutely.
One thing everybody needs to keep in mind is, again, a substantive policy statement only provides guidance as to how the board is interpreting an existing statute or rule. If there's something that needs to be modified, that would be done through a statute itself. And you can't expand or change regulation at all through a substantive policy statement. That would be an illegal abuse of board power. So what if there's something that, and this may be something that is indicated by a substantive policy statement lasting too long, a substantive policy statement may indicate a need for greater clarity in a statute. But if it's not something that is regulated, or if the regulation says X, you can't use a substantive policy statement to change the regulation at all. All it is purely just interpreting an existing statute or rule. So it starts getting a little dangerous when you start looking at maybe adding something or removing something that may have a substantive impact on regulation itself.
The only reference I'm looking at here is referencing, you know, it does not negate the professional rules of conduct. But so, yeah, it does seem like it should fall under use of seals, though.
I think so. I think we need to get rid of this.
Yeah, but
well, again, this is another one. Leave it in here until we get the rule change promulgated. Until then.
Okay.
I think we probably still need the guidance for it. And again, this is more for plan reviewers than for registrants. Go on to the next one.
Okay.
Well, before you leave this one, this is really a business decision. I mean, any architect worth his salt would know to do this.
Right,
that's why I made the statement.
This isn't necessarily for the registrants we regulate. This is more for the plan reviewers who don't understand what our regulations are.
Right. Okay.
They're looking for a seal on every sheet.
It's on the checklist.
It's on the checklist, sealed by a registrant. Oh, here's a sheet that has a bunch of details on it, and it's not sealed.
And I could probably go through a bunch of set of plans that I currently have in my inbox and show you where the engineer has sealed every damn sheet anyways, because they rolled out the Mylars in front of him, and they were already plotted, and you didn't even look those on the sheet.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Okay.
Have to stop the discussion until...
Pause.
For the record, Mr. Bartlett walked out of the room.
Have a
lost quarrel.
His stuff's still here. His phone's still here. He's not going anywhere.
Five minute break.
Hide it.
Yeah.
Aren't we ending at
2:30, 2:45.
Oh.
We are back in session. Use of electronic seals and signatures. It's another one.
More use of seals.
Yeah.
This has been a problem. What's the date on this one?
2002.
Well, it was just as they were coming out, if I remember this correctly, with, you know, because Stuart and I worked on this with the, you know, from the county perspective when we were up both in Mojave County,
And the issue at the time was there was a great confusion with it, obviously, because it was still in its infancy. And the only thing I would say is I still see, I'm mentioning names, but it seems to be some confusion that of what that is still. And when I'm talking about a professional document that does not have the registrant's official seal on it, but has this electronic signature on it in place of the seal.
Not an electronic seal you're talking
about. Not an electronic seal, an electronic signature. In place of
the seal and signature?
There's no seal on it.
There's no seal, just the signature.
Just the electronic signature.
Yeah, I would consider
that. And it says on there that I don't disagree. I don't disagree. But I still think there's some confusion in there, but it's limited. So, I mean, I would agree that it's not probably applicable anymore. It's certainly not the way it's written here. So, but
is there a reason to have something about electronic seals? I don't know.
Well, it's, you know, there was, you know, back in that time, too, there was also, like, the, you know, it's better now than what it was then, but you could electronically seal an electronic document, like an AutoCAD drawing or something, so that if they changed it or it was broken, it blew it's what we call signatures now. I mean, for like Adobe and stuff like that. And if the signature is violated, then that document is null. You're not responsible for it anymore. And that's really what a lot of that was at that time, was the digital stuff that I remember anyways. That was more of the, you know, we released the digital drawings and there's no way to protect it. But the,
I mean, I sign stuff now a lot electronically, where the client sends me something and it has, you know, we click on it,
put some
fake, you know, my initials on there, but I didn't put them on it. It's the electronic version of it. And I mean, do we need to?
I don't think you need this anymore. If we want to do anything, I would say we can still rescind this one completely, but at the same time, put it in our list of things to look at in rule under use of seals. To see if we need to clarify, this was
updated.
To clarify, and this was more to clarify the rule because of changing and emerging technology at the time, rather than have to go through rulemaking just for this one element. And I think what we would do, since we're going to open that can of worms of rulemaking, let's make sure that we have something in the rules that address electronic seals and signatures.
May. G, R43304, use of seals G. Electronic signature has an option to a permanently legible signature in accordance with ARS Title 41 and Title 44 is acceptable for all professional documents. The registrant shall provide adequate security regarding the use of the sealing signature.
Then we already have it. So this definitely needs to go.
But then when you're referring to electrical seals, what is the definition of that? A plotted seal on there that's not a wet stamp?
Yeah.
See, that's the... Because
there's the seal and there's the signature.
They're two different things, right?
My seal's been dry for probably since this was initiated. I mean, I've wet sealed a couple things.
In Arizona, Pinal and Pima County both, when I record a survey, they want a wet seal on it. They want a wet signature anyways. They don't care about the seal, but they want a wet signature on it. If I am producing, like, if I have a two-sheet drawing, and the only way they can tell is because the signature is the exact same in two or three different places, but they want me to wet. And now in Nevada, it has to still be wet sealed. The survey does.
So this is referencing one statute that's not even doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah. No, this needs to go.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow.
I still think there's some.
Is that the 32-125?
41-132 is gone. It's not there.
Okay.
44-701 just says this chapter may be cited as the Arizona Electronic Transactions Act. That's it.
Oh.
And then 4470-43 is just an interoperability, basically, I think, encouraging government agencies to adopt similar standards and electronic signature use adopted by the Secretary of State, you know, electronic signature. It doesn't...
Well, it's certainly not an issue anymore. People that we know who accepts what, but that one incident or that one case that I'm calling out is something that has just always intrigued me that, you know, like I said, there's no registrant seal on the surveys. It's just a digital signature. It says that he's an Arizona LLS and has an LLS number on it. It doesn't have the seal, per se. So. Mm.
I'm not sure that number wouldn't be a violation.
Yeah, I'm not so sure either, but I
take out number
repeal
five.
Repeal on number five.
Yeah, repeal number five.
Yeah.
Yep, and we're not in a position to present anything right now, but Orlene and Julie and I all sat in on a webinar recently on electronic seals and the security of electronic seals, and we're trying to do a deep dive into that as well, because they were talking about a lot of other jurisdictions and what they do or don't do and what's going on, what's available, technology, things like that. It's pretty interesting. So I said now would be the time to really figure out if we need another change, if we're looking at all these
And we may, and part of what promulgated this was the whole notion that technology was changing. I mean, technology is changing. I don't know what we still do. I think we've taken it out of the rules, but for a long time under use of seals, it would talk about sealing video cassettes, discs, floppy disks.
I've sealed CDs before.
CDs, I have too. But, you know.
Not now, floppy disks.
Video cassettes are still there.
What's that?
A register shall apply a label that describes the name of the project and original imprint of the original seal and signature on all video cassettes that contain copies of professional documents.
So we have some cleaning up to do in regards to that. Because there's a lot of data exchange and information exchange is more and more seamless.
Right.
I have engineers working on Revit models up here in Phoenix that are all tied to one model on a server in the cloud, and we're working on this stuff, and we're sharing that model with a contractor, and there's no way to seal that.
Well, yeah, you know, the electronic stuff.
How do you seal that?
And it affects all of us.
The documents that are produced out of that Revit model get sealed. So there's a
Judith says they're going to find a way.
But there's, you know.
Well, it affects all of us a little bit differently. Like for surveyors, once we record the thing, that's the public document. Whatever's in a CAD file doesn't mean anything anymore. Topographic surveying and mapping can be affected, but I just don't. We don't release those to many people except other professionals, so it's not.
It's not a sealable document.
It's not
required to be.
Yeah.
It's another collaborating professional. So anyway, I think we need to start looking at.
Yeah.
Effective technology on use of seals.
So number five, yeah.
So number six, we'll let Peter deal with that one.
Well, this is all going to change on us in the new rules, but the we just had to write what was acceptable to the board as far as the surety bond goes. It's outdated. It is 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And as long as the rules have covered this now, have they not? We have anything in rule? I mean, I can only imagine this being a problem if a new surety company was writing the bond for the first time.
Well, the question here is this basically using the language the bond should have? The statute change that we're looking at is changing the amount. However, is this? I think this is the only thing that kind of clarifies what the bond language should be for the bond companies. Is this substantive policy?
Right. It is nowhere else, right?
As far as I understand.
Good. So, clarifying language. Should we clarify that language in the statute?
Well, we'll have to clarify the amount.
That could be an appendix in rule. If you need that specific language, could be like as referenced in Appendix A or whatever. Mm. I can show you examples from another board.
When we were doing this, every surety company was asking what this board wanted in there. You know, how they wanted it worded, because they never wrote them before. But now they have written them before. I don't know if that's going to make a difference.
I think definitely there's a lot more insurance than bonds that come in. But this, my opinion, shouldn't be in a policy statement. This should be in rule, clarifying what's in statute with the financial assurance. And we can create an appendix for that. So,
So I'd say number six is one we want to look at moving to.
You want to morph this into rule?
Yeah.
And at that time, eliminate the substantive policy statement.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with it. I still like the numbers on it.
Okay. It's 2:34. Is that our end time?
We're getting pretty close.
Close, but we could do number seven. Okay. Dating and signing seals and revisions. It's another one I remember.
Back to seals.
Well, you know, this is kind of, well, first of all, there's a lot of conflicts in it. It says, professional documents revised by the originating registrant after the date the seal is signed, the registrant may A, indicate the date, nature, and scope of the revisions, or B, reseal, resign, and redate with the current date. And then number four down below says it's not acceptable to change the date on the seal. Oops.
Okay.
Well, is that saying you can't scratch out the date on the seal and put a new date?
I guess it could,
something?
But I mean, that would, it just seems really strange. You know what? I mean, our procedure in my office is the date on the seal stays the same, and as revisions are issued, you have a delta block on your title block, and you go delta 1, delta 2, delta 3, you describe, do a very brief description and date of what that delta was, and you reissue the sheet.
I don't think this helps clarify.
I
no,
don't
that
think
seems
it does
very
that.
Unclear, doesn't it?
So, out.
Okay, that one's out.
All right,
number 7.
Eight's already gone.
Out.
Okay, good.
8's already gone?
Yep, it says rescinded in big... Okay.
Oh.
So I can tell you on this that I could pull any number of surveys off of the website right now where I could turn people in page after page after page for violating the minimum standards where it relates to this. Because they still don't set, they don't stamp monuments for section corners or, you know, they just set caps. They don't stamp it per the manual. So the policy statement has done nothing. And because everybody just ignored it the same way that they ignore the rule that's clearly in the minimum standard states that you're supposed to stamp them per the manual. This thing was put in here to clarify what that meant. You know, that was, and
the minimum standards are APLS standards.
The current minimum standards are accepted by the board.
Right.
That are listed on your website, yes.
As set forth by AZPLS.
And set forth by APLS, yes.
So leave this one.
No, I think it's done nothing, and the only way that this would ever get fixed is that we look at them maybe in enforcement. You know, the guy reset three section corners, and he set his cap with a number on them. No, you know, and gig them that way, and that's the only way they know.
Mike, is this something that they should be doing that they're not doing, or is this something that when you were looking at
this is something they should be doing that gets overlooked by a lot of surveyors. Mm. And the reason for that is, I mean, there's multiple reasons for that, but, I mean, you can have multiple monuments at a section corner, and nobody's actually copying to the fact that they're setting the section corner and stamping it appropriately so you know what that monument is. A rebar and a cap, even on a... If I put that on a survey and I call it that, you're going to know, but in the field, it's supposed to be stamped per the manual for reference to what that it is, a reestablishment of a cadastral corner, which is a little different than the reestablishment of a lot corner or something like that. So, yeah. It's an identification thing, more than anything else, but I don't think
dump it.
I think you could dump it because it's clear. It's actually clear in the standards.
Yeah.
And if we wanted to turn people in for them, we'd just violate them per that standard. I mean, it's just that I've never seen, other than maybe subsequential stuff in an enforcement case, that, well, we're gigging them all the rest of this stuff. You guys should probably set your monuments correctly. I mean, it's not the end of the world, and it's not harming the public by any means. It's more of a standard of care. And identification of monumentation.
Well,
and I suppose somewhere we can go in there and find that, you know, there would be some confusion on the public's part. But the confusion, the public's not going to know whether it's got an LS number on it or it's stamped with something, the general public wouldn't know the difference anyways, unless, you know, we show it as a property corner or something like that, which if you own an allocated portion of a section or something, then it is also your boundary corner.
So if it was something that was done incorrectly, say, and not stamped, and somebody goes in to purchase the land or something, and then there's some nightmare dispute because the survey was somehow done incorrectly.
Well, procedurally replacement, that's a totally different issue. This is just for stamping the monument. Hmm. I mean, if I set the monument wrong and I stamped it correctly, it would still be set wrong. It wouldn't make it. We don't have the authority to make it a section corner. Only the BLM can go in and resend a survey, and, you know, when they set a new monument, and then the old ones are no longer.
Yeah, because how do you get four monuments in the same corner?
Oh my God, don't, you don't have that time for that conversation
today. Okay.
You really don't.
I'm hearing dump that one.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Did you dump it? Because the question was regarding the board's interpretation of what a new survey is.
Well, there's, that's.
Okay.
And the new, and what happened was there was people that were saying at the time that I didn't do a new survey, I retraced a survey.
Right.
But
this substantial policy statement is identifying that a new survey, a present survey, and a most recent survey are all the same thing.
They are. Yeah. And but I don't know that. Well, you're looking at 11. We're still
on 9.
Oh,
you're on 9.
Yeah.
I apologize.
You confused me. That's a different.
I'm looking at 10. Yeah.
Yeah. No, but this is just for, it's just for stamping.
I thought you threw 9 away.
Okay, so
we
yeah.
I would say
9.
So, yeah.
So 9 gone.
Okay, yeah. All right. Nice.
So, knowing that we may have further discussion on 10, 11, and 12, because I know you've got to leave.
I know.
13 can go away because we no longer have oversight of drug lab site remediation.
Oh, come on.
I just picked an easy one.
Oh, thank you. That's great. Yes, 13. Easy.
And then there was one more. What was it?
Yeah, the survey ones. There's a couple other in here. That,
yeah.
Let me do a little poking around and see what I.
Okay, we can come back to the rest. I mean,
yeah,
I appreciate your time immensely on the ones that we were able to get through.
All mine have been rescinded already. We got rid of them in
one
rules and rules and standards.
Yeah, survey monuments, that's 12, 11.
Is 19 going to be thrown up?
Which one?
19, multi-pane.
I don't see a 19.
Assemblies.
There isn't much to it. It's all
Yeah, because
16.
It's on page 102. It's the last page.
All the way down. That must be it there.
Glazing assemblies.
What?
Multi-pane glazing.
Glazing assemblies.
Oh, that was for you guys. You just did that. It's 2018, wasn't it?
19, there 19. It is. Oh, yeah, these guys wanted to change glazing.
Only glazing I know as a surveyor is donuts.
That's best kind of glazing.
I think maybe the new standards would, because you're going to fix that.
I think it did, actually.
I think it did, too.
The new standards did. So we ought to keep this in place until then. Okay?
All right, so we got 2 minutes.
Because they're worried about more than just dual pane. They're worried about film and everything else. And we put that in the new standard. So you got to keep it until then.
All right. We entertain a motion to adjourn.
Moved.
Seconded.
In favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. We're done. Thank you all.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you all very much.